insatiable eyes are dancing with malice. The uncomfortable feeling that the crow is amused by the sight of him bent over his bike makes Sonny think of his magnum. Turn you into a mess of bloody feathers, baby. Without unfolding its wings, the crow hops backward and disappears into the oak leaves. Go! Beezer shouts. The moment Mouse charges in, little Nancy's rotting hands clamp down on his shoulders. Her thin bones press down on the leather hard enough to leave bruises on his skin. Although he knows this is impossible, you cannot get rid of what does not exist, the sudden flare of pain causes him to try to shake her off. He twitches his shoulders and wiggles the handlebars, and the bike wobbles. As the bike dips, little Nancy digs in harder. When Mouse rights himself, she pulls herself forward, wraps her bony arms around his chest, and flattens her body against his back. Her skull grinds against the nape of his neck, her teeth bite down on his skin. It is too much. Mouse had known she would reappear, but not that she would put him in a vice. And despite his speed, he has the feeling that he is traveling through a substance heavier and more viscous than air, a kind of syrup that slows him down, holds him back. Both he and the bike seem unnaturally dense, as if gravity exerts a stronger pull on the little road than anywhere else. His head pounds, and already he can hear that dog growling in the woods off to his right. He could take all of that, he supposes, if it were not for what stopped him the last time he drove up this path, a dead woman. Then she was Kiz Martin. Now the dead woman is little Nancy, and she is riding him like a dervish, slapping his head, punching him in the side, battering his ears. He feels her teeth leave his neck and sink into the left shoulder of his jacket. One of her arms whips in front of him, and he enters a deeper level of shock and horror when he realizes that this arm is visible. Rags of skin flutter over long bones. He glimpses white maggots wriggling into the few remaining knots of flesh. A hand that feels both sponge-like and bony flaps onto his cheek and crawls up his face. Mouse cannot keep it together anymore. His mind fills with white panic, and he loses control of the bike. When he heads into the curve that leads to Black House, the wheels are already tilting dangerously, and Mouse's sideways jerk of revulsion pushes them over beyond the possibility of correction. As the bike topples, he hears the dog snarling from only a few yards away. The Harley smashes down on his left leg, then skids ahead, and he and his ghastly passenger slide after it. When Mouse sees Black House looming from its dark bower amid the trees, a rotting hand flattens over his eyes. His scream is a bright, thin thread of sound against the fury of the dog. A few seconds after going in, Beezer feels the air thicken and congeal around him. It's some trick, he tells himself, an illusion produced by the fisherman's mind-fuck toxins. Trusting that the others will not be suckered by this illusion, he raises his head and looks over Mouse's broad back and corn-road head to see the road curve to the left about 50 feet ahead. The thick air seems to weigh down on his arms and shoulders, and he feels the onset of the mother and father of all headaches, a dull, insistent pain that begins as a sharp twinge behind his eyes and moves thudding deeper into his brain. Beezer gives Doc a half-second of attention, and from what he sees, Doc is taking care of business. A glance at the speedometer tells him that he is traveling at 35 miles per hour and gathering steam, so they should be doing 60 by the time they come into the curve. Off to his left, a dog growls. Beezer hauls his pistol out of his pocket and listens to the growling keep pace with them as they speed toward the curve. The band of pain in his head widens and intensifies. It seems to push at his eyes from the inside, making them bulge in their sockets. The big dog, it has to be a dog, what else could it be, is getting closer, and the fury of its noises makes Beezer see a giant tossing head with blazing red eyes and ropes of slather whipping from a gaping mouth filled with shark's teeth. Two separate things destroy his concentration. The first is that he sees Mouse slamming himself back and forth on his bike as he goes into the curve, as if he's trying to scratch his back on the thickening air. The second is that the pressure behind his eyes triples in force, and immediately after he sees Mouse going into what is surely a fall, the blood vessels in his eyes explode. From deep red, his vision shifts rapidly to absolute black. An ugly voice starts up in his head saying, "Amy sat in my lap and hugged me. I made up my mind to eat her. How she dud, 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 kick and scratch. I choked her to death." "No!" Beezer shouts, and the voice that is pushing at his eyes drops into a rasping chuckle. For less than a second, he gets a vision of a tall, shadowy creature and a single eye, a flash of teeth beneath a hat or a hood. And the world abruptly revolves around him, and he ends up flat on his back with the bike weighing on his chest. Everything he sees is stained a dark, seething red. Mouse is screaming, and when Beezer turns his head in the direction of the screams, he sees a red mouse lying on a red road with a huge red dog barreling toward him. Beezer cannot find his pistol. It went sailing into the woods. Shouts, screams, and the roar of motorcycles fill his ears. He scrambles out from under the bike, yelling he knows not what. A red dock flashes by on his red bike and almost knocks him down again. He hears a gunshot, then another. Doc sees Beezer glance at him and tries not to show how sick he feels. Dishwater boils in his stomach and his guts are writhing. It feels like he's going about 5 miles an hour. The air is so thick and rancid. For some reason, his head weighs 30 or 40 pounds. Damnedest thing! It would almost be interesting if he could stop the disaster happening inside him. The air seems to concentrate itself, to solidify, and then boom, his head turns into a super heavyweight bowling ball that wants to drop onto his chest. A giant, growling sound comes from out of the woods beside him, and Doc almost yields to the impulse to puke. He is dimly aware that Beezer is pulling out his gun, and he supposes he should do the same. But part of his problem is that the memory of a child named Daisy Temperley has moved into his mind, and the memory of Daisy Temperley paralyzes his will. As a resident in surgery at the University Hospital in Urbana, Doc had performed under supervision nearly 100 operations of every sort and assisted at as many. Until Daisy Temperley was wheeled into the OR, all of them had gone well. Complicated, but not especially difficult or life-threatening, her case involved bone grafts and other repair work. Daisy was being put back together again after a serious auto accident, and she had already endured 2 previous surgeries. 2 hours after the start of the procedure, the head of the department, Doc's supervisor, was called away for an emergency operation, and Doc was left in charge. Partly because he had been sleep-deprived for 48 hours, partly because in his exhaustion he had pictured himself cruising along the highway with Beezer, Mouse, and his other new friends, he made a mistake. Not during the operation, but after it. While writing a prescription for medication, he miscalculated the dosage, and 2 hours later Daisy Temperley was dead. There were things he could have done to rescue his career, but he did none of them. He was allowed to finish his residency, and then he left medicine for good. Talking to Jack Sawyer, he had vastly simplified his motives. The uproar in the middle of his body can no longer be contained. Doc turns his head and vomits as he races forward. It is not the first time he has puked while riding, but it is the messiest and the most painful. The weight of his bowling ball head means that he cannot extend his neck, so vomit spatters against his right shoulder and right arm. And what comes leaping out of him feels alive and equipped with teeth and claws. He is not surprised to see blood mixed with the vomit erupting from his mouth. His stomach doubles in on itself with pain. Without meaning to, Doc has slowed down, and when he accelerates and faces forward again, he sees Mouse topple over sideways and skid behind his bike into the curve up ahead. His ears report a rushing sound, like that of a distant waterfall. Dimly, Mouse screams. Equally dimly, Beezer shouts, "No!" Right after that, the Beez runs headlong into a big rock or some other obstruction because his electroglide leaves the ground, flips completely over in the compacted air, and comes down on top of him. It occurs to Doc that this mission is totally foobar. The whole world has hung a left, and now they are in deep shit. He does the only sensible thing. He yanks his trusty 9mm out of his pocket and tries to figure out what to shoot first. His ears pop, and the sounds around him surge into life. Mouse is still screeching. Doc cannot figure out how he missed hearing the noise of the dog before, because even with the roaring of the cycles and Mouse's screams, that moving growl is the loudest sound in the woods. The fucking Hound of the Baskervilles is racing toward them, and both Mouse and Beezer are out of commission. From the noise it makes, the thing must be the size of a bear. Doc aims the pistol straight ahead and steers with one hand as he blasts by Beezer, who is wriggling out from beneath his bike. That enormous sound, Doc imagines a bear-sized dog widening its chops around Mouse's head and instantly erases the image. Things are happening too fast, and if he doesn't pay attention, those jaws could close on him. He has just time enough to think, "That's no ordinary dog, not even a huge one," when something enormous and black comes charging out of the woods to his right and cuts on a diagonal toward Mouse. Doc pulls the trigger, and at the sound of the pistol, the animal whirls halfway around and snarls at him. All Doc can see clearly are two red eyes and an open red mouth with a long tongue and a lot of sharp canine teeth. Everything else is smudgy and indistinct, with no more definition than if it were covered in a swirling cape. A lightning bolt of pure terror that tastes as clean and sharp as cheap vodka pierces Doc from gullet to testicles, and his bike slews its rear end around and comes to a halt. He has stopped it out of sheer reflex. Suddenly it feels like deep night. Of course he can't see it. How could you see a black dog in the middle of the night? The creature whirls around again and streaks toward Mouse. "It doesn't want to charge me because of the gun and because the other two guys are right behind me," Doc thinks. His head and arms seem to have gained another 40 pounds apiece, but he fights against the weight of his muscles and straightens his arms and fires again. This time he knows he hits that thing, but its only reaction is to shudder off course for a moment. The big smudge of its head swings toward Doc. The growling gets even louder, and long, silvery streams of dog drool fly from its open mouth. Something that suggests a tail switches back and forth. When Doc looks into the open, red gash, his resolve weakens. His arms get heavier, and he is scarcely capable of holding his head upright. He feels as though he is falling down into that red maw. His pistol dangles from his limp hand. In a moment suspended throughout eternity, the same hand scribbles a post-op prescription for Daisy Temperley. The creature trots toward Mouse. Doc can hear Sonny's voice cursing furiously. A loud explosion on his right side seals both of his ears, and the world falls perfectly silent. "Here we are," Doc says to himself, "darkness at noon." For Sonny, the darkness strikes at the same time as the searing pain in his head and his stomach. A single band of agony rips right down through his body, a phenomenon so unparalleled and extreme that he assumes it has also erased the daylight. He and Kaiser Bill are 8 feet behind Beezer and Doc and about 15 feet up the narrow dirt road. The Kaiser lets go of his handlebars and grips the sides of his head. Sonny understands exactly how he feels. A 4-foot section of red-hot iron pipe has been thrust through the top of his head and pushed down into his guts, burning everything it touches. "Hey, man," he says, in his misery noticing that the air has turned sludgy, as though individual atoms of oxygen and carbon dioxide are gummy enough to stick to his skin. Then Sonny notices that the Kaiser's eyes are swimming up toward the back of his head, and he realizes that the man is passing out right next to him. Sick as he is, he has to do something to protect the Kaiser. Sonny reaches out for the other man's bike, watching as well as he can the disappearance of the Kaiser's irises beneath his upper eyelids. Blood explodes out of his nostrils, and his body slumps backward on the seat and rolls over the side. For a couple of seconds, he is dragged along by a boot caught in the handlebars, but the boot slips off, and the cycle drifts to a halt. The red-hot iron bar seems to rupture his stomach, and Sonny has no choice. He lets the other bike fall and utters a groan and bends sideways and vomits out what feels like every meal he has ever eaten. When nothing is left inside him, his stomach feels better, but John Henry has decided to drive giant rail spikes through his skull. His arms and legs are made of rubber. Sonny focuses on his bike. It seems to be standing still. He does not understand how he can go forward, but he watches a blood-spattered hand gun his bike and manages to stay upright when it takes off. "Is that my blood?" he wonders, and remembers two long red flags unfurling from the Kaiser's nose. A noise that had been gathering strength in the background turns into the sound of a 747 coming in for a landing. Sonny thinks that the last thing he wants to do today is get a look at the animal capable of making that sound. Mouse was right on the money. This is a bad, bad place, right up there with the charming town of Harco, Illinois. Sonny wishes to encounter no more Harcos, okay? One was enough. So why is he moving forward instead of turning around and running for the sunny piece of Highway 35? Why is he pulling that massive gun out of his pocket? It's simple. He is not about to let that jet airplane dog mess up his homies, no matter how much his head hurts. John Henry keeps pounding in those $5 spikes while Sonny picks up speed and squints at the road ahead, trying to figure out what is going on. Someone screams. He cannot identify who. Through the growling, he hears the unmistakable sound of a motorcycle hitting the ground after a flip, and his heart shivers. Beezer should always be point man, he thinks, otherwise we're asking for punishment. A gun goes off with a loud explosion. Sonny forces himself to press through the gluey atoms in the air, and after another 5 or 6 seconds he spots Beezer, who is painfully pushing himself upward beside his toppled bike. A few feet beyond Beezer, Doc's bulky figure comes into view, sitting astride his bike and aiming his 9 at something in the road ahead of him. Doc fires, and red flame bursts from the barrel of his pistol. Feeling more beat up and useless than ever before in his life, Sonny jumps from his moving bike and runs toward Doc, trying to look past him. The first thing he sees is a flash of light off Mouse's bike, which comes into view flat on its side about 20 feet down the road at the top of the curve. Then he finds Mouse on his ass and scrambling backward from some animal Sonny can barely make out, except for its eyes and teeth. Unconscious of the stream of obscenities that pour from his mouth, Sonny levels his pistol at the creature and fires just as he runs past Doc. Doc just stands there. Doc is out for the count. The weird animal up on the road closes its jaws on Mouse's leg. It is going to rip away a hamburger-sized chunk of muscle, but Sonny hits it with a fucking hollow-point missile from his Magnum, a bit show-offy for target practice, but under the circumstances no more than prudent, thank you very much. Contrary to all expectations and the laws of physics, Sonny's amazing wonder bullet does not knock a hole the size of a football in the creature's hide. The wonder bullet pushes the animal sideways and distracts it from Mouse's leg. It does not even knock it down. Mouse sends up a howl of pain. The dog whips around and glares at Sonny with red eyes the size of baseballs. Its mouth opens on jagged white teeth, and it snaps the air. Ropes of slime shoot out of its jaws. The creature lowers its shoulders and steps forward. Amazingly, its snarling grows in volume and ferocity. Sonny is being warned. If he does not turn and run, he is next on the menu. "Fuck that," Sonny says, and fires straight at the animal's mouth. Its whole head should fly apart in bloody rags. But for a second after the Magnum goes off, nothing changes. Oh, shit, Sonny thinks. The dog thing's eyes blaze, and its feral, wedge-shaped head seems to assemble itself out of the darkness in the air and emerge into view. As though an inky robe had been partially twitched aside, Sonny can see a thick neck descending to meaty shoulders and strong front legs. Maybe the tide is turning here. Maybe this monster will turn out to be vulnerable after all. Sonny braces his right wrist with his left hand, aims at the dog thing's chest, and squeezes off another round. The explosion seems to stuff his ears with cotton. All the railroad spikes in his head heat up like electric coils, and bright pain sings between his temples. Dark blood gouts from the creature's brisket. At the center of Sonny Cantanaro's being, a pure, primitive triumph bursts into life. More of the monster melts into visibility, the wide back and a suggestion of its rear legs. Of no recognizable breed and 4.5 feet high, the dog thing is approximately the size of a gigantic wolf. When it moves toward him, Sonny fires again. Like an echo, the sound of his gun repeats from somewhere close behind. A bullet like a supercharged wasp zings past his chest. The creature staggers back, limping on an injured leg. Its enraged eyes bore into Sonny's. He risks glancing over his shoulder and sees Beezer braced in the middle of the narrow road. "Don't look at me, shoot!" Beezer yells. His voice seems to awaken Doc, who raises his arm and takes aim. Then all three of them are pulling their triggers, and the little road sounds like the firing range on a busy day. The dog thing, hellhound, Sonny thinks, limps back a step and opens wide its terrible mouth to howl in rage and frustration. Before the howl ends, the creature gathers its rear legs beneath its body, springs across the road, and vanishes into the woods. Sonny fights off the impulse to collapse under a wave of relief and fatigue. Doc swivels his body and keeps firing into the darkness behind the trees, until Beezer puts a hand on his arm and orders him to stop. The air stinks of cordite and some animal odor that is musky and disgustingly sweet. Pale gray smoke shimmers almost white as it filters upward through the darker air. Beezer's haggard face turns to Sonny, and the whites of his eyes are crimson. "You hit that fucking animal, didn't you?" Through the wads of cotton in his ears, Beezer's voice sounds small and tinny. "Shit, yes. At least twice, probably three times. And Doc and I hit it once apiece. What the hell is that thing?" "What the hell is right?" Sonny says. Weeping with pain, Mouse, a third time, repeats his cry of, "Help me!" And the others hear him at last. Moving slowly and pressing their hands over whatever parts of their bodies hurt the most, they hobble up the road and kneel in front of Mouse. The right leg of his jeans is ripped and soaked with blood, and his face is contorted. "Are you assholes deaf?" "Pretty near," Doc says. "Tell me you didn't take a bullet in your leg." "No, but it must be some kind of miracle." He winces and inhales sharply. Air hisses between his teeth. "Way you guys were shooting. Too bad you couldn't draw a bead before it bit my leg." "I did," Sonny says. "Reason you still got a leg." Mouse peers at him, then shakes his head. "What happened to the Kaiser?" "He lost about a liter of blood through his nose and passed out," Sonny tells him. Mouse sighs as if at the frailty of the human species. "I believe we might try to get out of this crazy shithole." "Is your leg all right?" Beezer asks. "It's not broken, if that's what you mean, but it's not all right either." "What?" Doc asks. "I can't say," Mouse tells him. "I don't answer medical questions from guys all covered in puke." "Can you ride?" "Fuck yes, Beezer. You ever know me when I couldn't ride?" Beezer and Sonny each take a side, and with excruciating effort lift Mouse to his feet. When they release his arms, Mouse lumbers sideways a few steps. "This is not right," he says. "That's brilliant," says Beezer. "Bees, old buddy, you know your eyes are like bright red, you look like fucking Dracula." To the extent that hurry is possible, they are hurrying. Doc wants to get a look at Mouse's leg. Beezer wants to make sure that Kaiser Bill is still alive. And all of them want to get out of this place and back into normal air and sunlight. Their heads pound and their muscles ache from strain. None of them can be sure that the dog thing is not preparing for another charge. As they speak, Sonny has been picking up Mouse's fat boy and rolling it toward its owner. Mouse takes the handles and pushes his machine forward, wincing as he goes. Beezer and Doc rescue their bikes, and 6 feet along, Sonny pulls his upright out of a snarl of weeds. Beezer realizes that when he was at the curve in the road, he failed to look for Black House. He remembers Mouse saying, "This shit doesn't want to be seen," and he thinks Mouse got it just about right. The fisherman did not want them there, and the fisherman did not want his house to be seen. Everything else was spinning around in his head, the way his Electroglide had spun over after that ugly voice spoke up in his mind. Beezer was certain of one thing, however. Jack Sawyer was not going to hold out on him any longer. Then a terrible thought struck him, and he asked, "Did anything funny, anything really strange happen to you guys before the dog from hell jumped out of the woods? Besides the physical stuff, I mean." He looks at Doc, and Doc blushes. "Hello," Beezer thinks. Mouse says, "Go fuck yourself. I'm not going to talk about that." "I'm with Mouse," Sonny says. "I guess the answer is yes," Beezer says. Kaiser Bill is lying by the side of the road with his eyes closed and the front of his body wet with blood from mouth to waist. The air is still gray and sticky. Their bodies seem to weigh 1,000 pounds, the bikes to roll on leaden wheels. Sonny walks his bike up beside the Kaiser's supine body and kicks him, not all that gently, in the ribs. The Kaiser opens his eyes and groans. "Fuck, Sonny," he says. "You kicked me." His eyelids flutter and he lifts his head off the ground and notices the blood soaking into his clothing. "What happened? Am I shot?" "You conducted yourself like a hero," Sonny says. "How do you feel?"
"Lousy. Where was I hit?"
"How am I supposed to know?" Sonny says. "Come on, we're getting out of here." The others file past. Kaiser Bill manages to get to his feet and after another epic struggle hauls his bike upright beside him. He pushes it down the track after the others, marveling at the pain in his head and the quantity of blood on his body. When he comes out through the last of the trees and joins his friends on Highway 35, the sudden brightness stabs his eyes, his body feels light enough to float away, and he nearly passes out all over again.
"I don't think I did get shot," he says.
No one pays any attention to the Kaiser. Doc is asking Mouse if he wants to go to the hospital.
"No hospital, man. Hospitals kill people."
"At least let me take a look at your leg."
"Fine, look."
Doc kneels at the side of the road and tugs the cuff of Mouse's jeans up to the bottom of his knee. He probes with surprisingly delicate fingers, and Mouse winces. "Mouse," he says, "I've never seen a dog bite like this before."
"Never saw a dog like that before either,"
the Kaiser says.
"What dog?"
"There's something funny about this wound," Doc says. "You need antibiotics, and you need them right away."
"Don't you have antibiotics?"
"Sure I do."
"Then let's go back to Beezer's place and you can stick me full of needles."
"Whatever you say," says Doc. Chapter 20. Around the time Mouse and Beezer first failed to see the little road and the no trespassing sign beside it, Jack Sawyer answers the annoying signal of his cell phone, hoping that his caller will turn out to be Henry Layden with information about the voice on the 911 tape. Although an identification would be wonderful, he does not expect Henry to ID the voice. The fisherman Burnside is Potsy's age, and Jack does not suppose the old villain has much of a social life, here or in the territories. What Henry can do, however, is to apply his finely tuned ears to the nuances of Burnside's voice and describe what he hears in it. If we did not know that Jack's faith in his friend's capacity to hear distinctions and patterns inaudible to other people was justified,
that faith would seem as irrational as the belief in magic. Jack trusts that a refreshed, invigorated Henry Layden will pick up at least one or two crucial details of history or character that will narrow the search. Anything that Henry picks up will interest Jack. If someone else is calling him, he intends to get rid of whoever it is fast. The voice that answers his greeting revises his plans. Fred Marshall wants to talk to him, and Fred is so wound up and incoherent that Jack must ask him to slow down and start over. "Judy's flipping out again," Fred says, "just babbling and raving and getting crazy like before, trying to rip through the walls. Oh, God, they put her in restraints, and she hates that. She wants to help Ty. It's all because of that tape. Christ, it's getting to be too much to handle, Jack. Mr. Sawyer, I mean it, and I know I'm running off at the mouth, but I'm really worried." "Don't tell me someone sent her the 911 tape," Jack says. "No, not... what 911 tape? I'm talking about the one that was delivered to the hospital today, addressed to Judy. Can you believe they let her listen to that thing? I want to strangle Dr. Spiegelman and that nurse, Jane Bond. What's the matter with these people? The tape comes in, they say, 'Oh, goody, here's a nice tape for you to listen to, Mrs. Marshall. Hold on, I'll be right back with a cassette player.' On a mental ward? They don't even bother to listen to it first? Look, whatever you're doing, I'd be eternally grateful if you'd let me pick you up so I could drive you over there. You could talk to her. You're the only person who can calm her down." "You don't have to pick me up because I'm already on the way. What was on the tape?" "I don't get it." Fred Marshall has become considerably more lucid. "Why are you going there without me?" After a second of thought, Jack tells him an outright lie. "I thought you would probably be there already. It's a pity you weren't." "I would have had the sense to screen that tape before letting her hear it. Do you know what was on that thing?" "The fisherman," Jack says. "How did you know?" "He's a great communicator," Jack says. "How bad was it?" "You tell me and then we'll both know. I'm piecing it together from what I gathered from Judy and what Dr. Spiegelman told me later." Fred Marshall's voice begins to waver. "The fisherman was taunting her. Can you believe that? He said, 'Your little boy is very lonely.' Then he said something like, 'He's been begging and begging to call home and say hello to his mommy.' Except Judy says he has a weird foreign accent or a speech impediment or something, so he wasn't easy to understand right away. Then he says, 'Say hello to your mommy, Tyler.' And Tyler..." Fred's voice breaks, and Jack can hear him stifling his agony before he begins again. Tyler was apparently too distressed to do much but scream for help." A long, uncertain inhalation comes over the phone. "And he cried, Jack, he cried." Unable to contain his feelings any longer, Fred weeps openly, unguardedly. His breath rattles in his throat. Jack listens to all the wet, undignified, helpless noises people make when grief and sorrow cancel every other feeling, and his heart moves for Fred Marshall. The sobbing relents. "Sorry. Sometimes I think they'll have to put me in restraints." Was that the end of the tape? "He got on again." Fred breathes noisily for a moment, clearing his head, boasting about what he was going to do. "There will be more murders and more after that, Judy. We are all going to have such fun. Spiegelman quoted this junk to me. The children of French Landing will be harvested like wheat, harvested like wheat. Who talks like that? What kind of person is this?" "I wish I knew," Jack says. Maybe he was putting on an accent to sound even scarier, or to disguise his voice. He'd never disguise his voice, Jack thinks. He's too delighted with himself to hide behind an accent. "I'll have to get the tape from the hospital and listen to it myself, and I'll call you as soon as I have some information." "There's one more thing," Marshall says. "I probably made a mistake. Wendell Green came over about an hour ago." Anything involving Wendell Green is automatically a mistake. "So what happened?" "It was like he knew all about Tyler and just needed me to confirm it. I thought he must have heard from Dale or the state troopers, but Dale hasn't made us public yet, has he?" "Wendell has a network of little weasels that feed him information. If he knows anything, that's how he heard about it. What did you tell him?" "More or less everything," Marshall says, "including the tape. Oh, God, I'm such a dope. But I thought it'd be all right. I thought it would all get out anyhow.
Fred, did you tell him anything about me?
Only that Judy trusts you and that we're both grateful for your help, and I think I said that you would probably be going in to see her this afternoon.
Did you mention Ty's baseball cap?
Do you think I'm nuts? As far as I'm concerned, that stuff is between you and Judy. If I don't get it, I'm not going to talk about it to Wendell Green. At least I got him to promise to stay away from Judy. He has a great reputation, but I got the feeling he isn't everything he's cracked up to be.
You said a mouthful, Jack says. I'll be in touch. When Fred Marshall hangs up, Jack punches in Henry's number.
I may be a little late, Henry. I'm on my way to French County Lutheran. Judy Marshall got a tape from the fishermen, and if they'll let me have it, I'll bring it over. There's something strange going on here. On Judy's tape, I guess he has some kind of foreign accent.
Henry tells Jack there is no rush. He has not listened to the first tape yet, and now will wait until Jack comes over with the second one. He might hear something useful if he plays them in sequence. At least he could tell Jack if they were made by the same man.
And don't worry about me, Jack. In a little while, Mrs. Morton is coming by to take me over to KDCU. George Rathbun butters my bread today, baby. 6 or 7 radio ads.
Even a blind man knows you want to treat your honey, your sweetheart, your lovey-dovey, your wife, your best friend, through thick and thin to, fine dinner tonight. And there's no place better to show your appreciation to the old ball and chain than to take her to Cousin Buddy's Rib Crib on South Wabash Street in beautiful downtown La Riviere.
The old ball and chain?
You pay for George Rathbun, you get George Rathbun, warts and all.
Laughing, Jack tells Henry he will see him later that day and pushes the ram up to 70.
What is Dale going to do, give him a speeding ticket?
He parks in front of the hospital instead of driving around to the parking lot and trots across the concrete with his mind filled with the territories and Judy Marshall. Things are hurtling forward, picking up pace, and Jack has the sense that everything converges on Judy. No, on Judy and him. The fisherman has chosen them more purposefully than he did his first three victims. Amy St. Pierre, Johnny Erkenham, and Irma Freneau were simply the right age. Any three children would have done. But Tyler was Judy Marshall's son, and that set him apart. Judy has glimpsed the territories. Jack has traveled through them, and the fisherman lives there the way a cancer cell lives in a healthy organism. The fisherman sent Judy a tape, Jack a grisly present. At Tansy Freneau's, he had seen Judy as his key and the door it opened, and where did that door lead but into Judy's faraway? Faraway. God, that's pretty. Beautiful, in fact. Ah, the word evokes Judy Marshall's face. And when he sees that face, a door in his mind, a door that is his and his alone, flies open. And for a moment, Jack Sawyer stops moving altogether, and in shock, dread, and joyous expectation, freezes on the concrete 6 feet from the hospital's entrance. Through the door in his mind pours a stream of disconnected images. A stalled Ferris wheel, Santa Monica cops milling behind a strip of yellow crime scene tape, light reflected off a black man's bald head. Yes, a bald man's black head, that which he really and truly, in fact, most desperately, had not wished to see. So take a good look, kiddo, here it is again. There had been a guitar, but the guitar was elsewhere. The guitar belonged to the magnificent, demanding, comforting, comfortless Speedy Parker. God bless him, God damn his eyes, God love him, Speedy, who touched its strings and sang, "Travelin' Jack, oh, travelin' Jack, got a far long way to go, longer way to come back." Worlds spin around him, worlds within worlds, and other worlds alongside them, separated by a thin membrane composed of 1,000,000 doors, if only you know how to find them. 1,000,000 red feathers, tiny ones, feathers from a robin redbreast. Hundreds of robin redbreasts flew through one of those doors. Speedies.
Robin. As in Robin's Egg Blue, Thank You, Speedy, and a song that said, wake up, you sleepyhead. Or, wake up, you dunderhead. Crazily, Jack hears George Rathbun's now not-so-genial roar. Even a blind man could have seen this one coming, you knothead! Oh, yeah? Jack says out loud. It is a good thing head nurse Jane Bond, Warden Bond, Agent 00, cannot hear him. She's tough, but on the other hand, she's unfair. And if she were to appear beside him now, she would probably clap him in irons, sedate him, and drag him back to her domain. Well, I know something you don't know, old buddy. Judy Marshall has a twinner. And the twinner has been whispering through the wall for a considerable old time now. It's no surprise she finally started to shout. A red-haired teenager in an Arden HS baseball t-shirt shoves open the literal door 6 feet from Jack and gives him a wary, disconcerted look. Man, grown-ups are weird, the look says. Aren't I glad I'm a kid? Since he is a high school student and not a mental health professional, he does not clap our hero in irons and drag him sedated away to the padded room. He simply takes care to steer a wide course around the madman and keeps walking, albeit with a touch of self-conscious stiffness in his gait. It is all about twinners, of course. Rebuking his stupidity, Jack raps his knuckles against the side of his head. He should have seen it before. He should have understood immediately. If he has any excuse, it is that at first he refused to think about the case, despite Speedy's efforts to wake him up. Then became so caught up in concentrating on the fisherman that until this morning, while watching his mother on the sandbar's big TV, he had neglected to consider the monster's twinner. In Judy Marshall's childhood, her twinner had spoken to her through that membrane between the two worlds. Growing more and more alarmed over the past month, the twinner had all but thrust her arms through the membrane and shaken Judy senseless. Because Jack is single-natured and has no twinner, the corresponding task fell to Speedy. Now that everything seems to make sense, Jack cannot believe it has taken him so long to see the pattern. And this is why he has resented everything that kept him from standing before Judy Marshall. Judy is the doorway to her twinner, to Tyler, and to the destruction of both the fisherman and his opposite number in the territories, the builder of the satanic, fiery structure a crow named Gorg showed Tansy for no. Whatever happens on Ward D today, it is going to be world-altering. Heart-thrumming in anticipation, Jack passes from intense sunlight into the vast ochre space of the lobby. The same bath-robed patients seem to occupy the many chairs. In a distant corner, the same doctors discuss a troublesome case, or, who knows, that tricky tenth hole at Arden Country Club. The same golden lilies raise their luxuriant, attentive heads outside the gift shop. This repetition reassures Jack. It hastens his step, for it surrounds and cushions the unforeseeable events awaiting him on the fifth floor. The same board clerk responds to the proffer of the same password with an identical, if not the same, green card stamped visitor. The elevator, surprisingly similar to one in the Ritz Hotel on the Place Vendôme, obediently trembles upward past floors 2, 3, and 4, in its dowager-like progress, pausing to admit a gaunt young doctor who summons the memory of Roderick Usher, then releases Jack on 5, where the beautiful ochre light seems a shade or two darker than down there in the huge lobby. From the elevator, Jack retraces the steps he took with his guide, Fred Marshall, down the corridor, through the 2 sets of double doors, and past the way stations of gerontology and ambulatory ophthalmology and records annex, getting closer and closer to the unforeseen, unforeseeable, as the corridors grow narrower and darker, and emerges, as before, into the century-old room with high, skinny windows and a lot of walnut-colored wood. And there the spell breaks.
For the attendant seated behind the polished counter, the person currently the guardian of this realm, is taller, younger, and considerably more sullen than his counterpart of the day before. When Jack asks to see Mrs. Marshall, the young person glances in disdain at his visitor card and inquires if he should happen to be a relative or, another glance at the card, a medical professional. Neither, Jack admits, but if the young person could trouble himself to inform Nurse Bond that Mr. Sawyer wishes to speak to Mrs. Marshall, Nurse Bond is practically guaranteed to swing open the forbidding metal doors and wave him inward, since that is more or less what she did yesterday. That is all well and good if it happens to be true, the young person allows, but Nurse Bond is not going to be doing any door opening and waving in today, for today Nurse Bond is off duty. Could it be that when Mr. Sawyer showed up to see Mrs. Marshall yesterday, he was accompanied by a family member, say Mr. Marshall? Yes. And if Mr. Marshall were to be consulted, say via the telephone, he would urge the young fellow presently discussing the matter in a commendably responsible fashion with Mr. Sawyer to admit the gentleman promptly. That may be the case, the young person grants, but hospital regulations require that non-medical personnel in positions such as the young person's obtain authorization for any outside telephone calls. And from whom, Jack wishes to know, would this authorization be obtained? From the acting head nurse, Nurse Rack. Jack, who is growing a little hot, as they say, under the collar, suggests in that case that the young person seek out the excellent Nurse Rack and obtain the required authorization so that things might progress in the manner Mr. Marshall, the patient's husband, would wish. No, the young person sees no reason to pursue such a course, the reason being that doing so would represent a pitiful waste of time and effort. Mr. Sawyer is not a member of Mrs. Marshall's family. Therefore, the excellent Nurse Rack would under no circumstances grant the authorization. Okay, Jack says, wishing he could strangle this irritating pipsqueak. Let's move a step up the administrative ladder, shall we? Is Dr. Spiegelman somewhere on the premises?
Could be, the young person says. How am I supposed to know? Dr. Spiegelman doesn't tell me everything he does.
Jack points to the telephone at the end of the counter. I don't expect you to know. I expect you to find out. Get on that phone now. The young man slouches down the counter to the telephone, rolls his eyes, punches two numbered keys, and leans against the counter with his back to the room. Jack hears him muttering about Spiegelman, sigh, then say, "All right, transfer me, whatever." Transferred, he mutters something that includes Jack's name. Whatever he hears in response causes him to jerk himself upright and sneak a wide-eyed look over his shoulder at Jack. "Yes, sir. He's here now, yes. I'll tell him." He replaces the receiver. "Dr. Spiegelman will be here right away." The boy, he is no more than 20, steps back and shoves his hands in his pockets. "You're that cop, huh?" "What cop?" Jack says, still irritated.
"The one from California that came here and arrested Mr. Kinderling?"
"Yes, that's me."
"I'm from French Landing, and boy, that was some shock. To the whole town. Nobody would have guessed. Mr. Kinderling? Are you kidding? You'd never believe that someone like that would, you know, kill people."
"Did you know him?"
"Well, in a town like French Landing, everybody sort of knows everybody, but I didn't really know Mr. Kinderling except to say hi. The one I knew was his wife. She used to be my Sunday school teacher at Mount Hebron Lutheran."
Jack cannot help it. He laughs at the incongruity of the murderer's wife teaching Sunday school classes. The memory of Wanda Kinderling radiating hatred at him during her husband's sentencing stops his laughter, but it is too late. He sees that he has offended the young man. "What was she like?" he asks, "as a teacher?"
"Just a teacher," the boy says. His voice is uninflected, resentful. "She made us memorize all the books of the Bible."
He turns away and mutters,
"Some people think he didn't do it."
"What did you say?" The boy half turns toward Jack, but looks at the brown wall in front of him.
"I said, some people think he didn't do it, Mr. Kinderling." They think he got put in jail because he was a small-town guy who didn't know anybody out there.
That's too bad, Jack says. Do you want to know the real reason Mr. Kinderling went to prison?
The boy turns the rest of the way and looks at Jack.
Because he was guilty of murder and he confessed.
That's it. That's all.
Two witnesses put him at the scene, and two other people saw him on a plane to L.A. when he told everyone he was flying to Denver. After that, he said, okay, I did it. I always wanted to know what it was like to kill a girl, and one day I couldn't stand it anymore, so I went out and killed one. His lawyer tried to get him off on an insanity plea, but the jury at his hearing found him sane, and he went to prison.
The boy lowers his head and mumbles something.
I couldn't hear that, Jack says.
Lots of ways to make a guy confess.
The boy repeats the sentence just loud enough to be heard.
Then footsteps ring in the hallway, and a plump, white-coated man with steel-rimmed glasses and a goatee comes striding toward Jack with his hand out. The boy has turned away. The opportunity to convince the attendant that he did not beat a confession out of Thornburg Kinderling has slipped away. The smiling man with the white jacket and the goatee seizes Jack's hand, introduces himself as Dr. Spiegelman, and declares it a pleasure to meet such a famous personage.
Personage persiflage, Jack thinks. From one step behind the doctor, a man unnoticed until this moment steps fully into view and says,
Hey, doctor, do you know what would be perfect? If Mr. Famous and I interview the lady together. Twice the information in half the time. Perfect.
Jack's stomach turns sour. Wendell Green has joined the party. After greeting the doctor, Jack turns to the other man.
What are you doing here, Wendell? You promised Fred Marshall you'd stay away from his wife.
Wendell Green holds up his hands and dances back on the balls of his feet.
Are we calmer today, Lieutenant Sawyer? Not inclined to use a sucker punch on the hard-working press, are we? I have to say I'm getting a little tired of being assaulted by the police.
Dr. Spiegelman frowns at him.
What are you saying, Mr. Green?
Yesterday, before that cop knocked me out with his flashlight, Lieutenant Sawyer here punched me in the stomach for no real reason at all. It's a good thing I'm a reasonable man or I'd have filed lawsuits already.
But, Doctor, you know what? I don't do things that way.
I believe everything works out better if we cooperate with each other.
Halfway through this self-serving speech, Jack thinks, oh, hell, and glances at the young attendant. The boy's eyes burn with loathing. A lost cause. Now Jack will never persuade the boy that he did not mistreat Kinderling. By the time Wendell Green finishes congratulating himself, Jack has had a belly full of his specious, smarmy affability.
Mr. Green offered to give me a percentage of his take if I let him sell photographs of Irma Freneau's corpse, he tells the doctor.
What he is asking now is equally unthinkable. Mr. Marshall urged me to come here and see his wife, and he made Mr. Green promise not to come.
Technically, that may be true, Green says. As an experienced journalist, I know that people often say things they don't mean and will eventually regret. Fred Marshall understands that his wife's story is going to come out sooner or later.
Does he?
Especially in the light of the fisherman's latest communication, Green says.
This tape proves that Tyler Marshall is his fourth victim and that miraculously he is still alive. How long do you think that can be kept from the public? And wouldn't you agree that the boy's mother should be able to explain the situation in her own words?
I refuse to be badgered like this.
The doctor scowls at Green and gives Jack a look of warning.
Mr. Green, I am very close to ordering you out of this hospital. I wish to discuss several matters with Lieutenant Sawyer in private. If you and the lieutenant can work out some agreement between the two of you, that is your affair. I am certainly not going to permit a joint interview with my patient. I am in no way certain that she should talk to Lieutenant Sawyer either. She is calmer than she was this morning, but she is still fragile.
The best way to deal with her problem is to let her express herself, Green says.
You will be quiet now, Mr. Green, Dr. Spiegelman says.
The double chins that fold under his goatee turn a warm pink. He glares at Jack.
What specifically is it that you request, Lieutenant?
Do you have an office in this hospital, Doctor?
I do.
Ideally, I'd like to spend about half an hour, maybe less, talking to Mrs. Marshall,
in a safe, quiet environment where our conversation would be completely confidential. Your office would probably be perfect. There are too many people on the ward, and you can't talk without being interrupted or having other patients listen in.
My office, Spiegelman says.
If you're willing.
Come with me, the doctor says. Mr. Green, you will please stand back next to the counter while Lieutenant Sawyer and I step into the hallway.
Anything you say, Green executes a mocking bow and moves lightly with a suggestion of dance steps to the counter.
In your absence, I'm sure this handsome young man and I will find something to talk about.
Smiling, Wendell Green props his elbows on the counter and watches Jack and Dr. Spiegelman leave the room. Their footsteps click against the floor tiles until it sounds as though they have gone more than halfway down the corridor. Then there is silence. Still smiling, Wendell about faces and finds the attendant openly staring at him.
I read you all the time, the boy says. You write real good.
Wendell's smile becomes beatific. Handsome and intelligent. What a stunning combination. Tell me your name.
Ethan Evans.
Ethan, we do not have much time here, so let's make this snappy. Do you think responsible members of the press should have access to information the public needs?
You bet.
And wouldn't you agree that an informed press is one of our best weapons against monsters like the fishermen? A single vertical wrinkle appears between Ethan Evans's eyebrows.
Weapons?
Let me put it this way. Isn't it true that the more we know about the fisherman, the better chance we have of stopping him?
The boy nods, and the wrinkle disappears.
Tell me, do you think the doctor is going to let Sawyer use his office?
Probably, yeah, Evans says.
But I don't like the way that Sawyer guy works. He's a police brutality. Like when they hit people to make them confess, that's brutality.
I have another question for you. Two questions, really. Is there a closet in Dr. Spiegelman's office? And is there some way you could take me there without going through that corridor?
Oh, Evans's dim eyes momentarily shine with understanding.
You want to listen?
Listen and record. Wendell Green taps the pocket that contains his cassette recorder.
For the good of the public at large, God bless them one and all.
Well, maybe, yeah, the boy says. But Dr. Spiegelman, he...
A $20 bill has magically appeared, folded around the second finger of Wendell Green's right hand.
Act fast, and Dr. Spiegelman will never know a thing. Right, Ethan?
Ethan Evans snatches the bill from Wendell's hand and motions him back behind the counter, where he opens a door and says,
Come on, hurry.
Low lights burn at both ends of the dark corridor. Dr. Spiegelman says, I gather that my patient's husband told you about the tape she received this morning.
He did.
How did it get here, do you know?
Believe me, Lieutenant, after I saw the effect that tape had on Mrs. Marshall and listened to it myself, I tried to learn how it reached my patient. All of our mail goes through the hospital's mailroom before being delivered, all of it, whether to patients, medical staff, or administrative offices. From there, a couple of volunteers deliver it to the addresses. I gather that the package containing the tape was in the hospital mailroom when a volunteer looked in there this morning. Because the package was addressed only with my patient's name, the volunteer went to our general information office. One of the girls brought it up.
Shouldn't someone have consulted you before giving the tape and a cassette player to Judy?
Of course. Nurse Bond would have done so immediately, but she is not on duty today. Nurse Rack, who is on duty, assumed that the address referred to a childhood nickname and thought that one of Mrs. Marshall's old friends had sent her some music to cheer her up. And there is a cassette player in the nurse's station, so she put the tape in the player and gave it to Mrs. Marshall.
In the gloom of the corridor, the doctor's eyes take on a sardonic glint.
Then, as you might imagine, all hell broke loose. Mrs. Marshall reverted to the condition in which she was first hospitalized, which takes in a range of alarming behaviors. Fortunately, I happened to be in the hospital, and when I heard what had happened, I ordered her sedated and placed in a secure room. A secure room, Lieutenant, has padded walls. Mrs. Marshall had reopened the wounds to her fingers, and I did not want her to do any more damage to herself. Once the sedative had taken effect, I went in and talked to her. I listened to the tape. Perhaps I should have called the police immediately, but my first responsibility is to my patient, and I called Mr. Marshall instead. From where? From the secure room with my cell phone. Mr. Marshall, of course, insisted on speaking to his wife, and she wanted to speak to him. She became very distraught during their conversation, and I had to give her another mild sedative. When she calmed down, I went out of the room and called Mr. Marshall again to tell him more specifically about the contents of the tape. Do you want to hear it? Not now, Doctor, thanks. But I do want to ask you about one aspect of it. Then ask. Fred Marshall tried to imitate the way you had reproduced the accent of the man who made the tape. Did it sound like any recognizable accent to you? German, maybe? I've been thinking about that. It was sort of like a Germanic pronunciation of English, but not really. If it sounded like anything recognizable, it was English spoken by a Frenchman trying to put on a German accent, if that makes sense to you. But really, I've never heard anything like it. From the start of this conversation, Dr. Spiegelman has been measuring Jack, assessing him according to standards Jack cannot even begin to guess. His expression remains as neutral and impersonal as that of a traffic cop. Mr. Marshall informed me that he intended to call you. It seems that you and Mrs. Marshall have formed a rather extraordinary bond. She respects your skill at what you do, which is to be expected. But she also seems to trust you. Mr. Marshall asks that you be allowed to interview his wife, and his wife tells me that she must talk to you. Then you should have no problems with letting me see her in private for half an hour. Dr. Spiegelman's smile is gone as soon as it appears. My patient and her husband have demonstrated their trust in you, Lieutenant Sawyer. But that is not the issue. The issue is whether or not I can trust you. Trust me to do what? A number of things. Primarily, to act in the best interest of my patient. To refrain from unduly distressing her, also from giving her false hopes. My patient has developed a number of delusions centered on the existence of another world somehow contiguous to ours. She thinks her son is being held captive in this other world. I must tell you, Lieutenant, that both my patient and her husband believe you are familiar with this fantasy world. That is, my patient accepts this belief wholly, and her husband accepts it only provisionally, on the grounds that it comforts his wife. I understand that. There is only one thing Jack can tell the doctor now, and he says it. And what you should understand is that in all of my conversations with the Marshals, I have been acting in my unofficial capacity as a consultant to the French Landing Police Department and its chief, Dale Gilbertson. Your unofficial capacity? Chief Gilbertson has been asking me to advise him on his conduct of the fisherman investigation, and 2 days ago, after the disappearance of Tyler Marshall, I finally agreed to do what I could. I have no official status whatsoever. I'm just giving the chief and his officers the benefit of my experience. Let me get this straight, Lieutenant. You have been misleading the Marshals as to your familiarity with Mrs. Marshall's delusional fantasy world. I'll answer you this way, Doctor. We know from the tape that the fisherman really is holding Tyler Marshall captive. We could say that he is no longer in this world, but in the fisherman's. Dr. Spiegelman raises his eyebrows. Do you think this monster inhabits the same universe that we do? Asks Jack. I don't, and neither do you. The fisherman lives in a world all his own, one that operates according to fantastically detailed rules he has made up or invented over the years. With all due respect, my experience has made me far more familiar with structures like this than the marshals, the police, and, unless you have done a great deal of work with psychopathic criminals, even you. I'm sorry if that sounds arrogant, because I don't mean it that way. You're talking about profiling, something like that? Years ago, I was invited into a special VICAP profiling unit run by the FBI, and I learned a lot there, but what I'm talking about now goes beyond profiling. And that's the understatement of the year, Jack says to himself. Now it's in your court, Doctor. Spiegelman nods slowly. The distant glow flashes in the lenses of his glasses. I think I see, yes. He ponders. He sighs, crosses his arms over his chest, and ponders some more. Then he raises his eyes to Jack's. All right, I'll let you see her, alone, in my office, for 30 minutes. I wouldn't want to stand in the way of advanced investigative procedure. Thank you, Jack says. This will be extremely helpful, I promise you. I have been a psychiatrist too long to believe in promises like that, Lieutenant Sawyer, but I hope you succeed in rescuing Tyler Marshall. Let me take you to my office. You can wait there while I get my patient and bring her there by another hallway. It's a little quicker. Dr. Spiegelman marches to the end of the dark corridor and turns left, then left again, pulls a fat ball of keys from his pocket, and opens an unmarked door. Jack follows him into a room that looks as though it had been created by combining two small offices into one. Half of the room is taken up by a long wooden desk, a chair, a glass-topped coffee table stacked with journals and filing cabinets. The other half is dominated by a couch and a leather recliner placed at its head. Georgia O'Keeffe posters decorate the walls. Behind the desk stands a door Jack assumes opens into a small closet. The door directly opposite, behind the recliner and at the midpoint between the two halves of the office, looks as though it leads into an adjoining room. As you see, Dr. Spiegelman says, I use this space as both an office and a supplementary consulting room. Most of my patients come in through the waiting room, and I'll bring Mrs. Marshall in that way. Give me 2 or 3 minutes. Jack thanks him, and the doctor hurries out through the door to the waiting room. In the little closet, Wendell Green slides his cassette recorder from the pocket of his jacket and presses both it and his ear to the door. His thumb rests on the record button, and his heart is racing. Once again, Western Wisconsin's most distinguished journalist is doing his duty for the man in the street. Too bad it's so blasted dark in that closet, but being stuffed into a black hole is not the first sacrifice Wendell has made for his sacred calling. Besides, all he really needs to see is the little red light on his tape recorder. Then, a surprise. Although Dr. Spiegelman has left the room, here is his voice, asking for Lieutenant Sawyer. How did that Freudian quack get back in without opening or closing a door? And what happened to Judy Marshall? Lieutenant Sawyer, I must speak to you. Pick up the receiver. You have a call, and it sounds urgent. Of course. He is on the intercom. Who can be calling Jack Sawyer, and why the urgency? Wendell hopes that Golden Boy will push the telephone speaker button, but alas, Golden Boy does not, and Wendell must be content with hearing only one side of the conversation. A call? Jack says. Who's it from? He refused to identify himself, the doctor says. Someone you told you'd be visiting Ward D? Beezer, with news of Black House. How do I take the call? Just punch the flashing button, the doctor says. Line 1. I'll bring in Mrs. Marshall when I see you're off the line. Jack hits the button and says, Jack Sawyer. Thank God, says Beezer St. Pierre's honey and tobacco voice. Hey, man, you gotta get over to my place. The sooner the better. Everything got messed up. Did you find it? Oh, yeah. We found Black House, all right. It didn't exactly welcome us. That place wants to stay hidden, and it lets you know.
Some of the guys are hurting. Most of us will be okay, but Mouse, I don't know. He got something terrible from a dog bite, if it was a dog, which I doubt. Doc did what he could, but hell, the guy's out of his mind, and he won't let us take him to the hospital.
Beezer, why don't you take him anyway if that's what he needs?
We don't do things that way. Mouse hasn't stepped inside a hospital since his old man croaked in one. He's twice as scared of hospitals as of what's happening to his leg. If we took him to La Riviere General, he'd probably drop dead in the ER.
And if he didn't, he'd never forgive you.
You got it. How soon can you be here?
I still have to see the woman I told you about. Maybe an hour, not much longer than that anyhow.
Didn't you hear me? Mouse is dying on us. We got a whole lot of things to say to each other.
I agree, Jack says. Work with me on this, Bees. He hangs up, turns to the door near the consulting room chair, and waits for his world to change.
What the hell was that all about, Wendell wonders. He has squandered 2 minutes worth of tape on a conversation between Jack Sawyer and the dumb SOB who spoiled the film that should have paid for a nice car and a fancy house on a bluff above the river, and all he got was worthless crap.
Wendell deserves the nice car and the fancy house, has earned them thrice over, and his sense of deprivation makes him seethe with resentment. Golden boys get everything handed to them on diamond-studded salvers. People fall all over themselves to give them stuff they don't even need. But a legendary, selfless, working stiff, and gentleman of the press like Wendell Green? It costs Wendell Green $20 to hide in a dark, crowded little closet just to do his job.
His ears tingle when he hears the door open. The red light burns, the faithful recorder passes the ready tape from spool to spool, and whatever happens now is going to change everything. Wendell's gut, that infallible organ, his best friend, warms with the assurance that justice will soon be his. Dr. Spiegelman's voice filters through the closet door and registers on the spooling tape.
I'll leave you two alone now.
Golden Boy. Thank you, Doctor. I'm very grateful.
Dr. Spiegelman. 30 minutes, right? That means I'll be back at, 2:10.
Golden Boy, fine. The soft closing of the door, the click of the latch. Then long seconds of silence. Why aren't they talking to each other? But of course, the question answers itself. They're waiting for fat-ass Spiegelman to move out of hearing range.
Oh, this is just delicious, that's what this is. The whisper of Golden Boy's footsteps moving toward that door all but confirms the sterling reporter's intuition. Oh, gut of Wendell Green, oh, instrument marvelous and trustworthy, once more you come through with the journalistic goods. Wendell hears, the machine records, the inevitable next sound, the click of the lock.
Judy Marshall, don't forget the door behind you.
Golden Boy. How are you?
Judy Marshall, much, much better now that you're here. The door, Jack.
Another set of footsteps, another mistakable sliding into place of a metal bolt.
Soon to be ruined, boy.
I've been thinking about you all day. I've been thinking about this.
The harlot, the whore, the slut. Is half an hour long enough?
Him with foot in bear trap. If it isn't, he'll just have to bang on the doors.
Wendell barely restrains himself from crowing with delight. These two people are actually going to have sex together. They're going to rip off their clothes and have at it like animals. Man, talk about your paybacks. When Wendell Green is done with him, Jack Sawyer's reputation will be lower than the fisherman's.
Judy's eyes look tired. Her hair is limp, and her fingertips wear the startling white of fresh gauze. But besides registering the depth of her feeling, her face glows with the clear, hard-won beauty of the imaginative strength she called upon to earn what she has seen. To Jack, Judy Marshall looks like a queen falsely imprisoned. Instead of disguising her innate nobility of spirit, the hospital gown and the faded nightdress make it all the more apparent. Jack takes his eyes from her long enough to lock the second door, then takes a step toward her. He sees that he cannot tell her anything she does not already know. Judy completes the movement he has begun. She moves before him and holds out her hands to be grasped. "I've been thinking about you all day," he says, taking her hands. "I've been thinking about this." Her response takes in everything she has come to see, everything they must do. Is half an hour long enough? If it isn't, he'll just have to bang on the doors. They smile. She increases the pressure on his hands. Then let him bang. With the smallest, slightest tug, she pulls him forward, and Jack's heart pounds with the expectation of an embrace. What she does is far more extraordinary than a mere embrace. She lowers her head, and with two light, dry brushes of her lips, kisses his hands. Then she presses the back of his right hand against her cheek and steps back. Her eyes kindle. "You know about the tape?" He nods. "I went mad when I heard it. But sending it to me was a mistake. He pushed me too hard. Because I fell right back into being that child who listened to another child whispering through a wall. I went crazy and I tried to rip the wall apart. I heard my son screaming for my help. And he was there, on the other side of the wall. Where you have to go. Where we have to go. Where we have to go, yes. But I can't get through the wall, and you can. So you have work to do, the most important work there could be. You have to find Ty, and you have to stop the Abala. I don't know what that is exactly, but stopping it is your job. Am I saying this right? You are a coppiceman."
"You're saying it right," Jack says. "I am a coppiceman. That's why it's my job."
"Then this is right, too. You have to get rid of Gorg and his master, Mr. Munshun. That's not what his name really is, but it's what it sounds like, Mr. Munshun. When I went mad and I tried to rip through the world, she told me, and she could whisper straight into my ear. I was so close."
What does Wendell Green, ear and whirling tape recorder pressed to the door, make of this conversation? It is hardly what he expected to hear, the animal grunts and moans of desire busily being satisfied. Wendell Green grinds his teeth. He stretches his face into a grimace of frustration.
"I love that you've let yourself see," says Jack. "You're an amazing human being. There isn't a person in a thousand who could even understand what that means, much less do it."
"You talk too much," Judy says. "I mean, I love you.
In your way, you love me. But you know what? Just by coming here, you made me more than I was. There's this sort of beam that comes out of you, and I just locked onto that beam. Jack, you lived there, and all I could do was peek at it for a little while. That's enough, though. I'm satisfied. You and Ward D, you let me travel.
What you have inside you lets you travel."
"Okay. Three cheers for a well-examined spell of craziness. Now it's time. You have to be a coppiceman. I can only come halfway, but you'll need all your strength."
"I think your strength is going to surprise you.
Take my hands and do it, Jack. Go over. She's waiting, and I have to give you to her. You know her name, don't you?"
He opens his mouth, but cannot speak. A force that seems to come from the center of the earth surges into his body, rolling electricity through his bloodstream, tightening his scalp, sealing his trembling fingers to Judy Marshall's, which also tremble. A feeling of tremendous lightness and mobility gathers within all the hollow spaces of his body. At the same time, he has never been so aware of his body's obduracy, its resistance to flight. When they leave, he thinks, it'll be like a rocket launch. The floor seems to vibrate beneath his feet.
He manages to look down the length of his arms to Judy Marshall, who leans back with her head parallel to the shaking floor, eyes closed, smiling in a trance of accomplishment. A band of shivery white light surrounds her. Her beautiful knees, her legs shining beneath the hem of the old blue garment, her bare feet planted. That light shivers around him, too. All of this comes from her, Jack thinks, and from... A rushing sound fills the air, and the Georgia O'Keeffe prints fly off the walls. The low couch dances away from the wall, papers swirl up from the jittering desk. A skinny halogen lamp crashes to the ground. All through the hospital, on every floor, in every room and ward, beds vibrate, television sets go black, instruments rattle in their rattling trays, lights flicker. Toys drop from the gift shop shelves, and the tall lilies skid across the marble in their vases. On the fifth floor, light bulbs detonate into showers of golden sparks. The hurricane noise builds, builds, and with a great whooshing sound becomes a wide, white sheet of light, which immediately vanishes into a pinpoint and is gone. Gone, too, is Jack Sawyer, and gone from the closet is Wendell Green. Sucked into the territories, blown out of one world and sucked into another, blasted and dragged, man, we're 100 levels up from the simple, well-known flip. Jack is lying down, looking up at a ripped white sheet that flaps like a torn sail. A quarter of a second ago, he saw another white sheet, one made of pure light and not literal like this one. The soft, fragrant air blesses him. At first he is conscious only that his right hand is being held, then that an astonishing woman lies beside him, Judy Marshall. No, not Judy Marshall, whom he does love in his way, but another astonishing woman, who once whispered to Judy through a wall of night, and has lately drawn a great deal closer. He had been about to speak her name when, into his field of vision, moves a lovely face, both like and unlike Judy's. It was turned on the same lathe, baked in the same kiln, chiseled by the same besotted sculptor, but more delicately, with a lighter, more caressing touch. Jack cannot move for wonder. He is barely capable of breathing. This woman, whose face is above him now, smiling down with a tender impatience, has never been married or born a child, never traveled beyond her native territories, never flown in an airplane, driven a car, switched on a television, scooped ice ready-made from the freezer, or used a microwave. And she is radiant with spirit and inner grace. She is, he sees, lit from within. Humor, tenderness, compassion, intelligence, strength glow in her eyes and speak from the curves of her mouth, from the very molding of her face. He knows her name, and her name is perfect for her. It seems to Jack that he has fallen in love with this woman in an instant, that he enlisted in her cause on the spot. And at last he finds he can speak her perfect name. Sophie. Chapter 21. Sophie. Still holding her hand, he gets to his feet, pulling her up with him. His legs are trembling. His eyes feel hot and too large for their sockets. He is terrified and exalted in equal, perfectly equal measure. His heart is hammering, but oh, the beats are sweet. The second time he tries, he manages to say her name a little louder, but there's still not much to his voice. And his lips are so numb they might have been rubbed with ice.
He sounds like a man just coming back from a hard punch in the gut.
Yes. Sophie. Yes. Sophie. Yes.
There's something weirdly familiar about this, him saying the name over and over, and her giving back that simple affirmation. Familiar and funny. And it comes to him. There's a scene almost identical to this in The Terror of Deadwood Gulch, after one of the Lazy Eight Saloon's patrons has knocked Bill Towns unconscious with a whiskey bottle. Lily, in her role as sweet Nancy O'Neill, tosses a bucket of water in his face, and when he sits up, they...
This is funny, Jack says. It's a good bit. We should be laughing.
With the slightest of smiles, Sophie says,
Yes.
Laughing our fool heads off.
Yes.
Our tarnal heads off.
Yes.
I'm not speaking English anymore, am I?
No.
He sees two things in her blue eyes. The first is that she doesn't know the word English. The second is that she knows exactly what he means.
Sophie. Yes. Sophie, Sophie, Sophie.
Trying to get the reality of it. Trying to pound it home like a nail. A smile lights her face and enriches her mouth. Jack thinks of how it would be to kiss that mouth, and his knees feel weak. All at once he is 14 again, and wondering if he dares give his date a peck goodnight after he walks her home.
Yes, 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 she says, the smile strengthening.
And then,
have you got it yet? Do you understand that you're here, and how you got here?
Above and around him, billows of gauzy white cloth flap and sigh like living breath. Half a dozen conflicting drafts gently touch his face and make him aware that he carried a coat of sweat from the other world, and that it stinks. He arms it off his brow and cheeks in quick gestures, not wanting to lose sight of her for longer than a moment at a time. They are in a tent of some kind. It's huge, many-chambered, and Jack thinks briefly of the pavilion in which the Queen of the Territories, his mother's twinner, lay dying. That place had been rich with many colors, filled with many rooms, redolent of incense and sorrow, for the Queen's death had seemed inevitable. Sure, only a matter of time. This one is ramshackle and ragged. The walls and the ceiling are full of holes, and where the white material remains whole, it's so thin that Jack can actually see the slope of land outside and the trees that dress it. Rags flutter from the edges of some of the holes when the wind blows. Directly over his head, he can see a shadowy maroon shape, some sort of cross.
Jack? Do you understand how you...
Yes, I flipped. Although that isn't the word that comes out of his mouth. The literal meaning of the word that comes out seems to be Horizon Road. And it seems that I sucked a fair number of Spiegelman's accessories with me. He bends and picks up a flat stone with a flower carved on it. I believe that in my world, this was a Georgia O'Keeffe print. And that... He points to a blackened, fireless torch leaning against one of the pavilion's fragile walls. I think that was a... But there are no words for it in this world, and what comes out of his mouth sounds as ugly as a curse in German. Halogen lamp. She frowns.
Haldogen limp? Lamp?
He feels his numb lips rise in a little grin. Never mind.
But you are all right.
He understands that she needs him to be all right, and so he'll say that he is. But he's not. He is sick, and glad to be sick. He is one love-struck daddy, and wouldn't have it any other way. If you discount how he felt about his mother, a very different kind of love, despite what the Freudians might think, it's the first time for him. Oh, he certainly thought he had been in and out of love. But that was before today. Before the cool blue of her eyes, her smile, and even the way the shadows thrown by the decaying tent fleet across her face like schools of fish. At this moment he would try to fly off a mountain for her if she asked, or walk through a forest fire, or bring her polar ice to cool her tea. And those things do not constitute being all right. But she needs him to be. Tyler needs him to be. I am a coppiceman, he thinks. At first the concept seems insubstantial compared to her beauty, to her simple reality. But then it begins to take hold, as it always has. What else brought him here, after all? Brought him against his will and all his best intentions. Jack? Yes, I'm all right. I've flipped before. But never into the presence of such beauty, he thinks. That's the problem. You're the problem, my lady. Yes, to come and go is your talent. One of your talents. So I have been told. By whom? Shortly, she says. Shortly. There's a great deal to do, and yet I think I need a moment. You rather take my breath away. Jack is fiercely glad to know it. He sees he is still holding her hand, and he kisses it, as Judy kissed his hands in the world on the other side of the wall from this one. And when he does, he sees the fine mesh of bandage on the tips of three of her fingers. He wishes he dared to take her in his arms, but she daunts him, her beauty and her presence. She is slightly taller than Judy, a matter of 2 inches, surely no more. And her hair is lighter, the golden shade of unrefined honey spilling from a broken comb. She is wearing a simple cotton robe, white, trimmed with a blue that matches her eyes. The narrow V-neck frames her throat. The hem falls to just below her knees. Her legs are bare, but she's wearing a silver anklet on one of them, so slim it's almost invisible. She is fuller-breasted than Judy, her hips a bit wider. Sisters, you might think, except that they have the same spray of freckles across the nose and the same white line of scar across the back of the left hand. Different mishaps caused that scar, Jack has no doubt. But he also has no doubt that those mishaps occurred at the same hour of the same day. You're her twinner. Judy Marshall's twinner. Only the word that comes out of his mouth isn't twinner. Incredibly, dopily, it seems to be harp. Later he will think of how the strings of a harp lie close together, only a finger's touch apart. And he will decide that word isn't so foolish after all. She looks down, her mouth drooping, then raises her head again and tries to smile. Judy, on the other side of the wall. When we were children, Jack, we spoke together, often. Even when we grew up, although then we spoke in each other's dreams. He is alarmed to see tears forming in her eyes and then slipping down her cheeks. Have I driven her mad? Run her to lunacy? Please say I haven't. Nah, Jack says. She's on a tightrope, but she hasn't fallen off yet. She's tough, that one. You have to bring her Tyler back to her, Sophie tells him, for both of us. I've never had a child. I cannot have a child. I was mistreated, you see, when I was young. Mistreated by one you knew well. A terrible certainty forms in Jack's mind. Around them the ruined pavilion flaps and sighs in the wonderfully fragrant breeze. Was it Morgan? Morgan of Oris? She bows his head, and perhaps this is just as well. Jack's face is, at that moment, pulled into an ugly snarl. In that moment, he wishes he could kill Morgan Sloat's twinner all over again. He thinks to ask her how she was mistreated, and then realizes he doesn't have to. How old are you? 12, she says, as Jack has known she would say. It happened that same year, the year when Jackie was 12 and came here to save his mother. Or did he come here?
Is this really the territories? Somehow it doesn't feel the same. Almost, but not quite. It doesn't surprise him that Morgan would rape a child of 12 and do it in a way that would keep her from ever having children. Not at all. Morgan Sloat, sometimes known as Morgan of Orus, wanted to rule not just one world or two, but the entire universe. What are a few raped children to a man with such ambitions? She gently slips her thumbs across the skin beneath his eyes. It's like being brushed with feathers. She's looking at him with something like wonder. Why do you weep, Jack? The past, he says. Isn't that always what does it? And thinks of his mother, sitting by the window, smoking a cigarette, and listening while the radio plays Crazy Arms. Yes, it's always the past. That's where the hurt is, all you can't get over. Perhaps so, she allows. But there's no time to think about the past today. It's the future we must think about today. Yes, but if I could ask just a few questions. All right, but only a few. Jack opens his mouth, tries to speak, and makes a comical little gaping expression when nothing comes out. Then he laughs. You take my breath away, too, he tells her. I have to be honest about that. A faint tinge of color rises in Sophie's cheeks, and she looks down. She opens her lips to say something, then presses them together again. Jack wishes she had spoken and is glad she hasn't, both at the same time. He squeezes her hands gently, and she looks up at him, blue eyes wide. Did I know you when you were 12? She shakes her head. But I saw you, perhaps, in the Great Pavilion. My mother was one of the good queen's handmaidens. I was another, the youngest. You could have seen me then. I think you did see me. Jack takes a moment to digest the wonder of this, then goes on. Time is short. They both know this. He can almost feel it fleeting. You and Judy are twinners, but neither of you travel. She's never been in your head over here, and you've never been in her head over there. You talk through a wall. Yes. When she wrote things, that was you whispering through the wall. Yes. I knew how hard I was pushing her, but I had to. It's not just a question of restoring her child to her, important as that may be. There are larger considerations. Such as? She shakes her head. I am not the one to tell you. The one who will is much greater than I. He studies the tiny dressings that cover the tips of her fingers and muses on how hard Sophie and Judy have tried to get through that wall to each other. Morgan Sloat could apparently become Morgan of Orus at will. As a boy of 12, Jack had met others with that same talent. Not him, he was single-natured and had always been Jack in both worlds. Judy and Sophie, however, have proved incapable of flipping back and forth in any fashion. Something's been left out of them, and they could only whisper through the wall between the worlds. There must be sadder things, but at this moment he can't think of a single one. Jack looks around at the ruined tent, which seems to breathe with sunshine and shadow. Rags flap. In the next room, through a hole in the gauzy cloth wall, he sees a few overturned cots. What is this place? He asks. She smiles. To some, a hospital. Oh? He looks up and once more takes note of the cross. Maroon now, but undoubtedly once red. A red cross, stupid, he thinks. Oh, but isn't it a little, well, old? Sophie's smile widens, and Jack realizes it's ironic. Whatever sort of hospital this is, or was, he's guessing it bears little or no resemblance to the ones on General Hospital or ER. Yes, Jack, very old. Once there were a dozen or more of these tents in the territories on world and mid-world. Now there are only a few. Mayhap, just this one. Today it's here. Tomorrow, Sophie raises her hands, then lowers them. Anywhere. Perhaps even on Judy's side of the wall. Sort of like a traveling medicine show. This is supposed to be a joke, and he's startled when she first nods, then laughs and claps her hands. Yes, yes indeed, although you wouldn't want to be treated here. What exactly is she trying to say? I suppose not, he agrees, looking at the rotting walls, tattered ceiling panels, and ancient support posts. Doesn't exactly look sterile. Seriously, but her eyes are sparkling, Sophie says, yet if you were a patient, you would think it beautiful out of all measure. And you would think your nurses, the little sisters, the most beautiful any poor patient ever had. Jack looks around. Where are they? The little sisters don't come out when the sun shines. And if we wish to continue our lives with the blessing, Jack, we'll be gone our separate ways from here, long before dark. It pains him to hear her talk of separate ways, even though he knows it's inevitable. The pain doesn't dampen his curiosity, however. Once a coppiceman, it seems always a coppiceman. Why? Because the little sisters are vampires, and their patients never get well. Startled, uneasy, Jack looks around for signs of them. Certainly disbelief doesn't cross his mind. A world that can spawn werewolves can spawn anything, he supposes. She touches his wrist. A little tremble of desire goes through him. Don't fear, Jack. They also serve the beam. All things serve the beam. What beam? Never mind. The hand on his wrist tightens. The one who can answer your questions will be here soon, if he's not already. She gives him a sideways look that contains a glimmer of a smile. And after you hear him, you'll be more apt to ask questions that matter. Jack realizes that he has been neatly rebuked, but coming from her, it doesn't sting. He allows himself to be led through room after room of the great and ancient hospital. As they go, he gets a sense of how really huge this place is. He also realizes that in spite of the fresh breezes, he can detect a faint, unpleasant undersmell. Something that might be a mixture of fermented wine and spoiled meat. As to what sort of meat, Jack is afraid he can guess pretty well. After visiting over 100 homicide crime scenes, he should be able to. It would have been impolite to break away while Jack was meeting the love of his life, not to mention bad narrative business. So we didn't. Now, however, let us slip through the thin walls of the hospital tent. Outside is a dry but not unpleasant landscape of red rocks, broom sage, desert flowers that look a bit like seagull lilies, stunted pines, and a few barrel cacti. Somewhere not too far distant is the steady, cool sigh of a river. The hospital pavilion rustles and flaps as dreamily as the sails of a ship riding down the sweet chute of the trade winds. As we float along the great ruined tent's east side in our effortless and peculiarly pleasant way, we notice a strew of litter. There are more rocks with drawings etched on them. There is a beautifully made copper rose that has been twisted out of shape as if by some great heat. There is a small rag rug that looks as if it has been chopped in two by a meat cleaver. There's other stuff as well, stuff that has resisted any change in its cyclonic passage from one world to the other. We see the blackened husk of a television picture tube lying in a scatter of broken glass, several Duracell AA batteries, a comb, and, perhaps oddest, a pair of white nylon panties with the word Sunday written on one side in demure pink script. There has been a collision of worlds,
Here, along the east side of the hospital pavilion, is an intermingled detritus that attests to how hard that collision was. At the end of that littery plume of exhaust, the head of the comet, we might say, sits a man we recognize. We're not used to seeing him in such an ugly brown robe, and he clearly doesn't know how to wear such a garment, because if we look at him from the wrong angle, we can see much more than we want to. Or wearing sandals instead of wingtips, or with his hair pulled back into a rough horsetail and secured with a hank of rawhide. But this is undoubtedly Wendell Green. He is muttering to himself. Drool drizzles from the corners of his mouth. He is looking fixedly at an untidy crumple of foolscap in his right hand. He ignores all the more cataclysmic changes that have occurred around him, and focuses on just this one. If he can figure out how his Panasonic mini-corder turned into a little pile of ancient paper, perhaps he'll move on to the other stuff. Not until then. Wendell, we'll continue to call him Wendell, shall we, and not worry about any name he might or might not have in this little corner of existence, since he doesn't know it or want to, spies the Duracell AA batteries. He crawls to them, picks them up, and begins trying to stick them into the little pile of foolscap. It doesn't work, of course, but that doesn't keep Wendell from trying. As George Rathbun might say, give that boy a fly swatter and he'd try to catch dinner with it. Gah, says the coolie country's favorite investigative reporter, repeatedly poking the batteries at the foolscap. Get in. Get in. Get, damn it. Get in. The... A sound, the approaching jingle of what can only be, God help us, spurs, breaks into Wendell's concentration, and he looks up with wide, bulging eyes. His sanity may not be gone forever, but it's certainly taken the wife and kids and gone to Disney World. Nor is the current vision before his eyes apt to coax it back any time soon. Once in our world, there was a fine black actor named Woody Strode. Lily knew him, acted with him, as a matter of fact, in a late 60s American International stinkeroo called Execution Express. The man now approaching the place where Wendell Green crouches with his batteries and his handful of foolscap looks remarkably like that actor. He is wearing faded jeans, a blue chambray shirt, a neck scarf, and a heavy revolver on a wide leather gun belt in which 4 dozen or so shells twinkle. His head is bald, his eyes deep set. Slung over one shoulder by a strap of intricate design is a guitar. Sitting on the other is what appears to be a parrot. The parrot has 2 heads. No, no, says Wendell in a mildly scolding voice. Don't see that. He lowers his head and once more begins trying to cram the batteries into the handful of paper. The shadow of the newcomer falls over Wendell, who resolutely refuses to look up. Howdy, stranger, says the newcomer. Wendell carries on, not looking up. My name's Parkus. I'm the law around these parts. What's your handle? Wendell refuses to respond unless we can call the low grunts issuing from his drool-slicked mouth a response. I ask your name. When... says our old acquaintance, we can't really call him a friend, without looking up. When... Del... Green... I... Take your time, Parkus says, not without sympathy. I can wait till your branding iron gets hot. I... Newshawk. Oh, that what you are? Parkus hunkers. Wendell cringes back against the fragile wall of the pavilion. Well, don't dat just beat the bass drum at the front of the parade. Tell you what, I've seen fishhawks, and I've seen redhawks, and I've seen goshawks, but you're my first newshawk. Wendell looks up, blinking rapidly. On Parkus's left shoulder, one head of the parrot says, God is love. Go fuck your mother,
replies the other head.
All must seek the river of life,
says the first head.
Suck my tool,
says the second.
We grow toward God,
responds the first.
Piss up a rope,
invites the second. Although both heads speak equably, even in tones of reasonable discourse, Wendell cringes backward even farther, then looks down and furiously resumes his futile work with the batteries and the handful of paper, which is now disappearing into the sweat-grimy tube of his fist.
Don't mind him, Parker says. I sure don't hardly hear him anymore, and that's the truth. Shut up, boys.
The parrot falls silent.
One head's sacred, the other's profane, Parker says. I keep him around just to remind me that...
He is interrupted by the sound of approaching footsteps, and stands up again in a single, lithe and easy movement. Jack and Sophie are approaching, holding hands with the perfect unconsciousness of children on their way to school.
Speedy,
Jack cries, his face breaking into a grin.
Why, traveling Jack,
Parker says with a grin of his own.
Well met. Look at you, sir. You're all grown up.
Jack rushes forward and throws his arms around Parkus, who hugs him back and heartily. After a moment, Jack holds Parkus at arm's length and studies him.
You were older.
You looked older to me, at least, in both worlds. Still smiling, Parkus nods. And when he speaks again, it is in Speedy Parker's drawl.
Reckon I did look older, Jack. You were just a child, remember?
But Parkus waves one hand.
Sometimes I look older, sometimes not so old. It all depends on age is wisdom,
one head of the parrot says piously, to which the other responds, you senile old fuck.
Depends on the place and the circumstances,
Parkus concludes,
then says, and I told you boys to shut up. You keep on, I'm apt to wring your scrawny neck.
He turns his attention to Sophie, who is looking at him with wide, wondering eyes, as shy as a doe.
Sophie, he says, it's wonderful to see you, darling. Didn't I say he'd come? And here he is. Took a little longer than I expected, is all.
She drops him a deep curtsy, all the way down to one knee, her head bowed.
Thank you, Si, she says. Come in peace, gunslinger, and go your course along the beam with my love.
At this, Jack feels an odd, deep chill, as if many worlds had spoken in a harmonic tone, low but resonant. Speedy, so Jack still thinks of him, takes her hand and urges her to her feet.
Stand up, girl, and look me in the eye. I'm no gunslinger here, not in the borderlands, even if I do still carry the old iron from time to time. In any case, we have a lot to talk about. This is no time for ceremony. Come over to Rise with me, you two. We got to make palaver, as the gunslingers say. Or used to say, before the world moved on. I shot a good brace of grouse and think they'll cook up just fine.
What about... Jack gestures toward the muttering, crouched heap that is Wendell Green.
Why, he looks right busy, Parker says. Told me he's a news hawk.
I'm afraid he's a little above himself, Jack replies. Old Wendell here's a news vulture. Wendell turns his head a bit. He refuses to lift his eyes, but his lip curls in a sneer that may be more reflexive than real.
Heard that?
He struggles. The lip curls again, and this time the sneer seems less reflexive. It is, in fact, a snarl.
Golden boy, Hollywood.
He's managed to retain at least some of his charm and his joie de vivre, Jack says. Will he be okay here?
Not much with airy brain in its head comes near the little sister's tent, Parker says. He'll be okay. And if he smells something tasty on the breeze and comes for a look-see, why, I guess we can feed him.
He turns toward Wendell.
We're going just over yonder. If you want to come and visit, why, you just up and do her. Understand me, Mr. News Hawk?
Wendell, Green. Wendell Green, yes, sir. Parkus looks at the others. Go on, let's move.
We mustn't forget him, Sophie murmurs with a look back. It will be dark in a few hours.
No, Parkus agrees as they top the nearest rise. Wouldn't do to leave him beside that tent after dark. That wouldn't do at all.
There's more foliage in the declivity on the far side of the rise, even a little ribbon of creek, presumably on its way to the river Jack can hear in the distance. But it still looks more like northern Nevada than western Wisconsin. Yet, in a way, Jack thinks that makes sense. The last one had been no ordinary flip. He feels like a stone that has been skipped all the way across a lake. And as for poor Wendell, to the right of where they descend the far side of the draw, a horse has been tethered in the shade of what Jack thinks is a Joshua tree. About 20 yards down the draw to the left is a circle of eroded stones. Inside it, a fire, not yet lit, has been carefully laid. Jack doesn't like the look of the place much. The stones remind him of ancient teeth. Nor is he alone in his dislike. Sophie stops, her grip on his fingers tightening.
Parkus, do we have to go in there? Please say we don't.
Parkus turns to her with a kindly smile Jack knows well. A Speedy Parker smile, for sure.
The speaking demon's been gone from this circle many the long age, darling, he says, and you know that such as yon are best for stories.
Yet,
now's no time to give in to the willies, Parker tells her.
He speaks with a trace of impatience, and willies isn't precisely the word he uses, but only how Jack's mind translates it.
You waited for him to come in the little sister's hospital tent
only because she was there on the other side.
And now I want you to come along.
All at once he seems taller to Jack. His eyes flash. Jack thinks, a gunslinger. Yes, I suppose he could be a gunslinger. Like in one of Mom's old movies, only for real.
All right, she says low. If we must.
Then she looks at Jack. I wonder if you'd put your arm around me.
Jack, we may be sure, is happy to oblige.
As they step between two of the stones, Jack seems to hear an ugly twist of whispered words. Among them, one voice is momentarily clear, seeming to leave a trail of slime behind it as it enters his ear.
Drudge, drudge, drudge. Oh, the bleeding footsie, soon he comes. My good friend Munchon, and such a prize I have for him. Oh, ho, ho, ho.
Jack looks at his old friend as Parkus hunkers by a toe sack and loosens the drawstring at the top.
He's close, isn't he? The fisherman. And Black House, that's close, too.
Yep, Parkus says.
And from the sack he spills the gutted corpses of a dozen plump, dead birds. Thoughts of Irma Freneau re-enter Jack's head at the sight of the grouse, and he thinks he won't be able to eat. Watching as Parkus and Sophie skewer the birds on green sticks reinforces this idea. But after the fire is lit, and the birds begin to brown, his stomach weighs in, insisting that the grouse smell wonderful and will probably taste even better. Over here, he remembers, everything always does.
And here we are, in the speaking circle, Parkus says.
His smiles have been put away for the nonce. He looks at Jack and Sophie, who sit side by side and still holding hands, with somber gravity. His guitar has been propped against a nearby rock. Beside it, sacred and profane, sleeps, with its two heads tucked into its feathers, dreaming its no doubt bifurcated dreams.
The demon may be long gone, but the legends say such things leave a residue that may lighten the tongue.
Like kissing the Blarney Stone, maybe, Jack suggests. Parkus shakes his head.
No Blarney today.
Jack says, if only we were dealing with an ordinary scumbag, that I could handle. Sophie looks at him, puzzled.
He means a dust-off artist, Parkus tells her, a hard case.
He looks at Jack.
And in one way, that is what you're dealing with. Carl Beerstone isn't much, an ordinary monster, let's say. Which is not to say he couldn't do with a spot of killing. But as for what's going on in French Landing, he has been used. Possessed, you'd say, in your world, Jack. Taken by the spirits, we'd say, in the territories.
Or brought low by pigs, Sophie adds.
Yes, Parkus is nodding. In the world just beyond this borderland, mid-world, they would say he has been infested by a demon. But a demon far greater than the poor tattered spirit that once lived in this circle of stones.
Jack hardly hears that. His eyes are glowing. It sounded something like Beer Stein, George Potter told him last night, 1,000 years ago. That's not it, but it's close.
Carl Beerstone, he says. He raises a clenched fist, then shakes it in triumph. That was his name in Chicago. Burnside, here in French Landing. Case closed, game over, zip up your fly. Where is he, Speedy? Save me some time here. Shut up, Parkus says. The tone is low and almost deadly. Jack can feel Sophie shrink against him. He does a little shrinking himself. This sounds nothing like his old friend. Nothing at all.
You have to stop thinking of him as Speedy, Jack tells himself. That's not who he is or ever was. That was just a character he played. Someone who could both soothe and charm a scared kid on the run with his mother. Parkus turns the birds, which are now browned nicely on one side, and spitting juice into the fire.
I'm sorry to speak harsh to you, Jack, but you have to realize that your fisherman is pretty small fry compared to what's really going on.
Why don't you tell Tansy Freneau he's small fry? Why don't you tell Beezer St. Pierre?
Jack thinks these things, but doesn't say them out loud. He's more than a little afraid of the light he saw in Parkus's eyes.
Nor is it about twinners, Parkus says. You got to get that idea out of your mind. That's just something that has to do with your world and the world of the territories. A link. You can't kill some hard case over here and end the career of your cannibal over there. And if you kill him over there in Wisconsin, the thing inside will just jump to another host.
The thing...
When it was in Albert Fish, Fish called it the Monday Man. Fella you're after calls it Mr. Munshun. Both are only ways of trying to say something that can't be pronounced by any earthly tongue on any earthly world.
How many worlds are there, Speedy?
Many, Parkus says, looking into the fire. And this business concerns every one of them.
Why else do you think I've been after you like I have, sending you feathers, sending you robin's eggs, doing every damn thing I could to make you wake up?
Jack thinks of Judy scratching on walls until the tips of her fingers were bloody and feels ashamed. Speedy has been doing much the same thing, it seems.
Wake up, you dunderhead, he says.
Parkus seems caught between reproof and a smile.
For sure you must have seen me in the case that sent you running out of L.A.
Oh, man, why do you think I went?
You ran like Jonah when God told him to go preach against the wickedness in Nineveh. Thought I was going to have to send a whale to come and swallow you up.
I feel swallowed, Jack tells him. In a small voice, Sophie says,
I do too.
We've all been swallowed, says the man with the gun on his hip. We're in the belly of the beast, like it or not. It's Ka, which is destiny and fate. Your fisherman, Jack, is now your Ka, our Ka. This is more than murder, much more.
And Jack sees something that frankly scares the shit out of him. Lester Parker, a.k.a. Speedy, a.k.a. Parkus, is himself scared almost to death.
This business concerns the Dark Tower, he says.
Beside Jack, Sophie gives a low, desperate cry of terror and lowers her head. At the same time, she raises one hand and forks the sign of the evil eye at Parkus over and over. That gentleman doesn't seem to take it amiss.
He simply sets to work, turning the birds again on their sticks.
"Listen to me now," he says. "Listen and ask as few questions as you can. We still have a chance to get Judy Marshall's son back, but time is blowing in our teeth."
"Talk," Jack says. Parkus talks. At some point in his tale, he judges the birds done and serves them out on flat stones. The meat is tender, almost falling off the small bones. Jack eats hungrily, drinking deep of the sweet water from Parkus's water skin each time it comes around to him. He wastes no more time comparing dead children to dead grouse. The furnace needs to be stoked, and he stokes it with a will. So does Sophie, eating with her fingers and licking them clean without the slightest reserve or embarrassment. So, in the end, does Wendell Green, although he refuses to enter the circle of old stones. When Parkus tosses him a golden brown grouse, however, Wendell catches it with remarkable adroitness and buries his face in the moist meat.
"You asked, how many worlds?" Parkus begins. "The answer, in the high speech, is Dafan, worlds beyond telling."
With one of the blackened sticks, he draws a figure 8 on its side, which Jack recognizes as the Greek symbol for infinity.
"There is a tower that binds them in place. Think of it as an axle upon which many wheels spin, if you like. And there is an entity that would bring this tower down, Ram Abala."
At these words, the flames of the fire seem to momentarily darken and turn red. Jack wishes he could believe that this is only a trick of his overstrained mind, but cannot.
"The Crimson King," he says. "Yes. His physical being is pent in a cell at the top of the tower, but he has another manifestation, every bit as real, and this lives in Kanta Abala, the court of the Crimson King."
Two places at once. Given his journeying between the world of America and the world of the territories, Jack has little trouble swallowing this concept.
"Yes.
If he, or it, destroys the tower, won't that defeat his purpose? Won't he destroy his physical being in the process?"
"Just the opposite. He'll set it free to wander what will then be chaos, Dinta, the furnace. Some parts of Midworld have fallen into that furnace already."
"How much of this do I actually need to know?" Jack asks. He's aware that time is fleeting by on his side of the wall as well.
"Hard telling what you need to know and what you don't," Parkus says. "If I leave out the wrong piece of information, maybe all the stars go dark. Not just here, but in 1,000,000 universes. That's the pure hell of it. Listen, Jack, the king has been trying to destroy the tower and set himself free for time out of mind. Forever, mayhap. It's slow work, because the tower is bound in place by crisscrossing force beams that act on it like guy wires. The beams have held for millennia, and would hold for millennia to come. But in the last 200 years, that's speaking of time as you count it, Jack, to you, Sophie, it would be full Earth almost 500 times over."
"So long," she says. It's almost a sigh. "So very long."
"In the great sweep of things, it's as short as the gleam of a single match in a dark room. But while good things usually take a long time to develop, evil has a way of popping up full-blown and ready-made, like Jack out of his box. Ka is a friend to evil as well as to good. It embraces both. And speaking of Jack," Parkus turns to him, "you've heard of the Iron Age and the Bronze Age, of course."
Jack nods.
"On the upper levels of the tower, there are those who call the last 200 or so years in your world the Age of Poisoned Thought."
"That means you don't have to explain it to me," Jack says. "I knew Morgan Sloat, remember? I knew what he planned for Sophie's world."
"Yes, indeed.
The basic plan had been to turn one of the universe's sweetest honeycombs into first a vacation spot for the rich, then a source of unskilled labor, and finally a waste pit, probably radioactive. If that wasn't an example of poisoned thought, Jack doesn't know what is. Parker says, rational beings have always harbored telepaths among their number. That's true in all the worlds. But they're ordinarily rare creatures. Prodigies, you might say. But since the age of poisoned thought came on your world, Jack, infested it like a demon, such beings have become much more common. Not as common as slow mutants in the blasted lands, but common, yes. You speak of mind readers, Sophie says, as if wanting to be sure. Yes, Parkus agrees, but not just mind readers. Precognates, teleports, world jumpers, like old Traveling Jack here, in other words, and telekinetics. Mind readers are the most common, telekinetics the rarest, and the most valuable. To him, you mean, Jack says. To the Crimson King. Yes. Over the last 200 years or so, the Abala has spent a good part of his time gathering a crew of telepathic slaves. Most of them come from Earth and the territories. All of the telekinetics come from Earth. This collection of slaves, this gulag, is his crowning achievement. We call them breakers. He trails off, thinking. Then, do you know how a galley travels? Sophie nods, but Jack at first has no idea what Parkus is talking about. He has a brief lunatic vision of a fully equipped kitchen traveling down Route 66. Many oarsmen, Sophie says, then makes a rowing motion that throws her breasts into charming relief. Parkus is nodding. Usually slaves chained together. They, from outside the circle, Wendell suddenly sticks his own oar in. Spartcus. He pauses, frowning, then tries it again. Spartacus. What's he on about? Parkus asks, frowning. Any idea, Jack? A movie called Spartacus, Jack says. And you're wrong as usual, Wendell. I believe you're thinking about Ben-Hur. Looking sulky, Wendell holds out his greasy hands. More meat. Parkus pulls the last grouse from its sizzling stick and tosses it between two of the stones, where Wendell sits with his pallid, greasy face peering from between his knees. Fresh prey for the news, Hawk, he says. Now do us a favor and shut up. Or what? The old defiant gleam is rising in Wendell's eyes. Parkus draws his shooting iron partway from its holster. The grip, made of sandalwood, is worn, but the barrel gleams murder bright. He has to say no more. Holding a second bird in one hand, Wendell Green hitches up his robe and hies himself back over the rise. Jack is extremely relieved to see him go. Spartacus indeed, he thinks, and snorts. So the Crimson King wants to use these breakers to destroy the beams, Jack says. That's it, isn't it? That's his plan. You speak as though of the future, Parkus says mildly. This is happening now, Jack. Only look at your own world if you want to see the ongoing disintegration. Of the 6 beams, only 1 still holds true. 2 others still generate some holding power. The other 3 are dead. One of these went out thousands of years ago in the ordinary course of things. The others killed by the breakers. All in 2 centuries or less. Christ, Jack says. He is beginning to understand how Speedy could call the fisherman small fry. The job of protecting the tower and the beams has always belonged to the ancient war guild of Gilead, called gunslingers in this world and many others. They also generated a powerful psychic force, Jack, one fully capable of countering the Crimson King's breakers. But the gunslingers are all gone, save for one, Sophie says, looking at the big pistol on Parkus's hip. And, with timid hope, unless you really are one too, Parkus. Not I, darling, he says. But there's more than one.
I thought Roland was the last, so the stories say.
He has made at least 3 others, Parkus tells her. I have no idea how that can be possible, but I believe it to be true. If Roland were still alone, the Breakers would have toppled the tower long since. But with the force of these others added to his, I have no clue what you're talking about, Jack says. I did, sort of, but you lost me about 2 turns back.
There's no need for you to understand it all in order to do your job, Parkus says.
Thank God for that.
As for what you do need to understand, leave galleys and oarsmen and think in terms of the Western movies your mother used to make. To begin with, imagine a fort in the desert.
This dark tower you keep talking about, that's the fort.
Yes. And surrounding the fort, instead of wild Indians, the Breakers, led by Big Chief Abala.
Sophie murmurs,
"The king is in his tower, eating bread and honey, the Breakers in the basement making all the money."
Jack feels a light but singularly unpleasant chill shake up his spine. He thinks of rat paws scuttering over broken glass.
"What? Why do you say that?"
Sophie looks at him, flushes, shakes her head, looks down.
"It's what she says sometimes, Judy. It's how I hear her sometimes."
Parkus seizes one of the charred green sticks and draws in the rocky dust beside the figure eight shape.
"Fort here. Marauding Indians here, led by their merciless, evil, and most likely insane chief. But over here..."
Off to the left, he draws a harsh arrow in the dirt. It points at the rudimentary shapes indicating the fort and the besieging Indians.
"What always arrives at the last moment in all the best Lily Cavanaugh westerns?"
"The cavalry," Jack says.
"That's us, I suppose."
"No," Parkus says. His tone is patient, but Jack suspects it is costing him a great effort to maintain that tone.
"The cavalry is Roland of Gilead and his new gunslingers. Or so those of us who want the tower to stand or to fall in its own time dare hope. The Crimson King hopes to hold Roland back and to finish the job of destroying the tower while he and his band are still at a distance. That means gathering all the Breakers he can, especially the telekinetics."
"Is Tyler Marshall..."
"Stop interrupting! This is difficult enough without that."
"You used to be a hell of a lot cheerier, Speedy," Jack says reproachfully. For a moment he thinks his old friend is going to give him another tongue-lashing, or perhaps even lose his temper completely and turn him into a frog. But Parkus relaxes a little and utters a laugh. Sophie looks up, relieved, and gives Jack's hand a squeeze.
"Oh, well, maybe you're right to yank on my cord a little," Parkus says. "Getting all wound up won't help anything, will it?"
He touches the big iron on his hip.
"I wouldn't be surprised if wearing this thing has given me a few delusions of grandeur."
"It's a step or two up from amusement park janitor," Jack allows.
"In both the Bible, your world, Jack, and the Book of Good Farming, yours, Sophie dear, there's a scripture that goes something like, 'For in my kingdom there are many mansions.' Well, in the court of the Crimson King, there are many monsters."
Jack hears a short, hard laugh bolt out of his mouth. His old friend has made a typically tasteless policeman's joke, it seems.
"They are the king's courtiers, his knights errant. They have all sorts of tasks, I imagine. But in these last years, their chief job has been to find talented breakers. The more talented the breaker, the greater the reward."
"They're headhunters," Jack murmurs, and doesn't realize the resonance of the term until it's out of his mouth. He has used it in the business sense, but of course there is another, more literal meaning. Headhunters are cannibals.
"Yes," Parkus agrees. "And they have mortal subcontractors who work for, one doesn't like to say for the joy of it, but what else could we call it?"
Jack has a nightmarish vision then. A cartoon Albert Fish standing on a New York sidewalk with a sign reading, "Will work for food." He tightens his arm around Sophie. Her blue eyes turn to him and he looks into them gladly. They soothe him. "How many breakers did Albert Fish send his pal Mr. Monday?" Jack wants to know. 2? 4? A dozen? And do they die off at least so the Abala has to replace them?
"They don't," Parkus replies gravely. "They are kept in a place, a basement, yes, or a cavern, where there is essentially no time. Purgatory. Christ. And it doesn't matter. Albert Fish is long gone. Mr. Monday is now Mr. Munchun. The deal Mr. Munchun has with your killer is a simple one. This Burnside can kill and eat all the children he wants, as long as they are untalented children. If he should find any who are talented, any breakers, they are to be turned over to Mr. Munchun at once."
"Who will take them to the Abala?" Sophie murmurs.
"That's right," Parkus says.
Jack feels that he's back on relatively solid ground and is extremely glad to be there. Since Tyler hasn't been killed, he must be talented.
"Talented is hardly the word. Tyler Marshall is potentially one of the 2 most powerful breakers in all the history of all the worlds. If I can briefly return to the analogy of the fort surrounded by Indians, then we could say that the breakers are like fire arrows shot over the walls, a new kind of warfare. But Tyler Marshall is no simple fire arrow. He's more like a guided missile or a nuclear weapon."
Sophie says, "I don't know what that is." "You don't want to," Jack replies. "Believe me." He looks down at the scribble of drawings in the dirt. Is he surprised that Tyler should be so powerful?
No, not really.
Not after experiencing the aura of strength surrounding the boy's mother. Not after meeting Judy's twinner, whose plain dress and manner can't conceal a character that strikes him as almost regal. She's beautiful, but he senses that beauty is one of the least important things about her.
"Jack," Parkus asks him, "you all right?"
"There's no time to be anything else," his tone suggests. "Give me a minute," Jack says.
"We don't have much time." "That has been made perfectly clear to me," Jack says, biting off the words,
and he feels Sophie shift in surprise at his tone of voice. "Now give me a minute. Let me do my job." From beneath a ruffle of green feathers, one of the parrot's heads mutters,
"God loves the poor laborer."
The other replies, "Is that why he made so fucking many of them?"
"All right, Jack," Parkus says, and cocks his head up at the sky.
"Okay, what have we got here?" Jack thinks. "We've got a valuable little boy, and the fisherman knows he's valuable. But this Mr. Munchun doesn't have him yet, or Speedy wouldn't be here."
"Deduction?"
Sophie, looking at him anxiously. Parkus, still looking up into the blameless blue sky above this borderland between the territories, what Judy Marshall calls far away, and the whatever comes next. Jack's mind is ticking faster now, picking up speed like an express train leaving the station. He is aware that the black man with the bald head is watching the sky for a certain malevolent crow. He is aware that the fair-skinned woman beside him is looking at him with the sort of fascination that could become love, given world enough and time. Mostly, though, he's lost in his own thoughts. They are the thoughts of a coppiceman. Now Beerstone's Burnside, and he's old. Old and not doing so well in the cognition department these days. I think maybe he's gotten caught between what he wants, which is to keep Tyler for himself, and what he's promised this Munchun guy. Somewhere there's a fuddled, creaky, dangerous mind trying to make itself up. If he decides to kill Tyler and stick him in the stew pot like the witch in Hansel and Gretel, that's bad for Judy and Fred, not to mention Tyler, who may already have seen things that would drive a Marine combat vet insane. If the fisherman turns the boy over to Mr. Munchun, it's bad for everyone in creation. No wonder Speedy said time was blowing in our teeth.
You knew this was coming, didn't you? He says. Both of you. You must have, because Judy knew. She's been weird for months, long before the murder started. Parker shifts and looks away uncomfortable.
I knew something was coming, yes. There have been great disruptions on this side. But I was on other business. And Sophie can't cross. She came here with the flying men and will go back the same way when our palaver is done.
Jack turns to her. You are who my mother once was. I'm sure of it. He supposes he isn't being entirely clear about this, but he can't help it. His mind is trying to go in too many directions at once. You're Laura DeLoessian's successor, the queen of this world. Now Sophie is the one who looks uncomfortable.
I was nobody in the great scheme of things. Really, I wasn't. And that was the way I liked it. What I did mostly was write letters of commendation and thank people for coming to see me. Only in my official capacity, I always said us. I enjoyed walking and sketching flowers and cataloging them. I enjoyed hunting. Then, due to bad luck, bad times, and bad behavior, I found myself the last of the royal line. Queen of this world, as you say, married once to a good and simple man. But my Fred Marshall died and left me alone. Sophie, the Baron.
Don't, Jack says. He is surprised at how deeply it hurts him to hear her refer to herself in this bitter, joking way. Were you not single nature, Jack, your twinner would be my cousin. She turns her slim fingers so that now she is gripping him instead of the other way around. When she speaks again, her voice is low and passionate. Put all the great matters aside. All I know is that Tyler Marshall is Judy's child, that I love her, that I'd not see her hurt for all the worlds that are. He's the closest thing to a child of my own that I'll ever have. These things I know, and one other. That you're the only one who can save him. Why? He has sensed this, of course. Why else in God's name is he here? But that doesn't lessen his bewilderment. Why me? Because you touched the talisman, and although some of its power has left you over the years, much still remains. Jack thinks of the lilies Speedy left for him in Dale's bathroom, how the smell lingered on his hands, even after he had given the bouquet itself to Tansy. And he remembers how the talisman looked in the murmuring darkness of the Queen's pavilion, rising brightly, changing everything, before it finally vanished. He thinks, it's still changing everything. Parkus, is it the first time he's called the other man, the other coppiceman, by that name? He doesn't know for sure, but he thinks it may be.
Yes, Jack.
What's left of the talisman? Is it enough? Enough for me to take on this Crimson King? Parkus looks shocked in spite of himself.
Never in your life, Jack. Never in any life. The Abala would blow you out like a candle. But it may be enough for you to take on Mr. Munshun, to go into the Furnace Lands and bring Tyler out.
These are machines, Sophie says. She looks caught in some dark and unhappy dream. Red machines and black machines, all lost in smoke. There are great belts and children without number upon them. They trudge and trudge, turning the belts that turn the machines, down in the foxholes, down in the rat holes where the sun never shines, down in the great caverns where the furnace lands lie.
Jack is shaken to the bottom of his mind and spirit. He finds himself thinking of Dickens, not Bleak House, but Oliver Twist. And, of course, he thinks of his conversation with Tansy Freneau. At least Irma's not there, he thinks. Not in the Furnace Lands, not she. She got dead and a mean old man ate her leg. Tyler, though. Tyler. They trudge until their feet bleed, he mutters.
And the way there?
I think you know it, Parkus says. When you find Black House, you'll find your way to the Furnace Lands, the Machines, Mr. Munshun, and Tyler.
The boy is alive. You're sure of that?
Yes, Parkus and Sophie speak together.
And where is Burnside now? That information might speed things up a bit.
I don't know, Parkus says.
Christ, if you know who he was, that was the fingerprints, Parkus says.
The fingerprints on the telephone. Your first real idea about the case. The Wisconsin State Police got the Beerstone name back from the FBI's VICAP database. You have the Burnside name. That should be enough.
Wisconsin State Police, FBI, VICAP database. These terms come out in good old American English. And in this place, they sound unpleasant and foreign to Jack's ear. How do you know all that?
I have my sources in your world. I keep my ear to the ground, as you know from personal experience. And surely you're cop enough to do the rest on your own.
Judy thinks you have a friend who can help, Sophie says unexpectedly.
Dale? Dale Gilbertson? Jack finds this a little hard to believe, but he supposes Dale may have uncovered something.
I don't know the name. Judy thinks he's like many here and far away, a man who sees much because he sees nothing.
Not Dale, after all. It's Henry she's talking about. Parkus rises to his feet. The heads of the parrot come up, revealing four bright eyes. Sacred and profane flutters up to his shoulder and settles there.
I think our palaver is done, Parkus says. It must be done. Are you ready to go back, my friend?
Yes. And I suppose I better take Green, little as I want to. I don't think he'd last long here.
As you say.
Jack and Sophie, still holding hands, are halfway up the rise when Jack realizes Parkus is still standing in the speaking circle with his parrot on his shoulder.
Aren't you coming? Parkus shakes his head. We go different ways now, Jack. I may see you again.
If I survive, Jack thinks, if any of us survive.
Meantime, go your course, and be true.
Sophie drops another deep curtsy.
Sigh.
Parkus nods to her and gives Jack Sawyer a little salute. Jack turns and leads Sophie back to the ruined hospital tent, wondering if he will ever see Speedy Parker again. Wendell Green, ace reporter, fearless investigator, explicator of good and evil to the great unwashed, sits in his former place, holding the crumpled foolscap in one hand and the batteries in the other. He has resumed muttering and barely looks up when Sophie and Jack approach.
You'll do your best, won't you? Sophie asks. For her?
And for you, Jack says. Listen to me now. If this were to end with all of us still standing, and if I were to come back here... He finds he can say no more. He's appalled at his temerity. This is a queen, after all, a queen. And he's... what? Trying to ask her for a date?
Perhaps, she says, looking at him with her steady blue eyes. Perhaps.
Is it a perhaps you want? He asks softly.
Yes.
He bends and brushes his lips over hers. It's brief, barely a kiss at all. It is also the best kiss of his life.
I feel like fainting, she tells him when he straightens up again.
Don't joke with me, Sophie. She takes his hand and presses it against the underswell of her left breast. He can feel her heart pounding.
Is this a joke?
If she were to run faster, she'd catch her feet and fall. She lets him go, but he holds his hand where it is a moment longer, palm curved against that springing warmth.
I'd come with you if I could, she says.
I know that. He looks at her, knowing if he doesn't get moving now, right away, he never will. It's wanting not to leave her, but that's not all. The truth is that he's never been more frightened in his life. He searches for something mundane to bring him back to Earth, to slow the pounding of his own heart,
and finds the perfect object in the muttering creature that is Wendell Green. He drops to one knee. Are you ready, big boy? Want to take a trip on the mighty Mississippi?
Don't touch me.
And then, in a nearly poetic rush, fucking Hollywood asshole. Believe me, if I didn't have to, I wouldn't. And I plan to wash my hands just as soon as I get the chance. He looks up at Sophie and sees all the Judy in her. All the beauty in her. I love you, he says. Before she can reply, he seizes Wendell's hand, closes his eyes, and flips. Chapter 22. This time, there's something that isn't quite silence. A lovely white rushing he has heard once before. In the summer of 1997, Jack went up way north to Vacaville with an LAPD skydiving club called the PF Flyers. It was a dare, one of those stupid things you got yourself into as a result of too many beers too late at night and then couldn't get yourself out of again, not with any grace. Which was to say, not without looking like a chicken shit. He expected to be frightened. Instead, he was exalted. Yet he had never done it again, and now he knows why. He had come too close to remembering, and some frightened part of him must have known it. It was the sound before you pulled the ripcord, that lonely white rushing of the wind past your ears. Nothing else to hear but the soft, rapid beat of your heart, and maybe the click in your ears as you swallowed saliva that was in free fall, just like the rest of you. Pull the ripcord, Jack, he thinks. Time to pull the ripcord, or the landing's gonna be awfully damn hard. Now there's a new sound, low at first, but quickly swelling to a tooth-rattling bray. Fire alarm, he thinks. And then, oh, it's a symphony of fire alarms. At the same moment, Wendell Green's hand is snatched out of his grip. He hears a faint squawking cry as his fellow skydiver is swept away, and then there's a smell, honeysuckle. No, it's her hair. And Jack gasps against the weight on his chest and his diaphragm, a feeling that the wind has been knocked out of him. There are hands on him, one on his shoulder, the other at the small of his back, hair tickling his cheek, the sound of alarms, the sound of people yelling in confusion, running footfalls that clack and echo. Jack, 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 are you all right? Ask a queen for a date, get knocked into the middle of next week, he mutters. Why is it so dark? Has he been blinded? Is he ready for that intellectually rewarding and financially remunerative job as an ump at Miller Park? Jack! A palm smacks his cheek, hard. Nope, not blind. His eyes are just shut. He pops them open, and Judy is bending over him, her face inches from his. Without thinking, he closes his left hand in the hair at the nape of her neck, brings her face down to his, and kisses her. She exhales into his mouth, a surprised reverse gasp that inflates his lungs with her electricity, and then kisses him back. He has never been kissed with such intensity in his entire life. His hand goes to the breast beneath her nightdress, and he feels the frenzied gallop of her heart. If she were to run faster, she'd catch her feet and fall, Jack thinks, beneath its firm rise. At the same moment, her hand slips inside his shirt, which has somehow come unbuttoned, and tweaks his nipple. It's as hard and hot as the slap. As she does it, her tongue darts into his mouth in one quick plunge, there and gone like a bee into a flower. He tightens his grip on the nape of her neck, and God knows what would have happened next. But at that moment, something falls over in the corridor with a huge crash of glass, and someone screams. The voice is high and almost sexless with panic, but Jack believes it's Ethan Evans, the sullen young person from the hall. Get back here! Stop running, gall darn it! Of course it's Ethan. Only a graduate of Mount Hebron Lutheran Sunday School would use gall darn it even in extremis. Jack pulls away from Judy. She pulls away from him. They are on the floor. Judy's nightdress is all the way up to her waist, exposing plain white nylon underwear. Jack's shirt is open, and so are his pants. His shoes are still on, but on the wrong feet, from the feel of them. Nearby, the glass-topped coffee table is overturned, and the journals that were on it are scattered.
Some seem to have been literally blown out of their bindings. More screams from the corridor, plus a few cackles and mad ululations. Ethan Evans continues to yell at stampeding mental patients, and now a woman is yelling as well, head nurse Rack, perhaps. The alarms bray on and on. All at once a door bursts open and Wendell Green gallops into the room. Behind him is a closet with clothes scattered everywhere, the spare items of Dr. Spiegelman's wardrobe all ahoo. In one hand, Wendell's holding his Panasonic minicorder. In the other, he has several gleaming tubular objects. Jack is willing to bet they're AA Duracells. Jack's clothes have been unbuttoned or perhaps blown open, but Wendell has fared much worse. His shirt is in tatters. His belly hangs over a pair of white boxer shorts, severely pea-stained in front. He is dragging his brown gabardine slacks by one foot. They slide across the carpet like a shed snakeskin. And although his socks are on, the left one appears to have been turned inside out.
"What did you do?" Wendell blares. "Oh, you Hollywood son of a bitch! What did you do to m—"
He stops. His mouth drops open. His eyes widen. Jack notes that the reporter's hair appears to be standing out like the quills on a porcupine. Wendell, meanwhile, is noting Jack Sawyer and Judy Marshall, embracing on the glass and paper-littered floor with their clothes disarranged. They aren't quite in flagrante delicious, but if Wendell ever saw two people on the verge, these are them. His mind is whirling and filled with impossible memories. His balance is shot. His stomach is chugging like a washing machine that has been overloaded with clothes and suds. He desperately needs something to hold on to. He needs news. Even better, he needs scandal. And here, lying in front of him on the floor, are both.
"Rape!"
Wendell bellows at the top of his lungs. A mad, relieved grin twists up the corners of his mouth.
"Sawyer beat me up, and now he's raping a mental patient!"
It doesn't look much like rape to Wendell, in all truth. But whoever yelled, "Consensual sex!" at the top of his lungs and attracted any attention. "Shut that idiot up," Judy says. She yanks down the hem of her nightgown and prepares to stand. "Watch out," Jack says, broken glass everywhere. "I'm okay," she snaps. Then, turning to Wendell with that perfect fearlessness Fred knew so well, "Shut up! I don't know who you are, but quit that bellowing. Nobody's being—" Wendell backs away from Hollywood Sawyer, dragging his pants along with him. "Why doesn't someone come?" he thinks. "Why doesn't someone come before he shoots me or something?" In his frenzy and near hysteria, Wendell has either not registered the alarms and general outcry, or believes them to be going on inside his head. Just a little more false information to go with his absurd memories of a black gunslinger, a beautiful woman in a robe, and Wendell Green himself crouching in the dust and eating a half-cooked bird like a caveman. "Keep away from me, Sawyer," he says, backing up with his hands held out in front of him. "I have an extremely hungry lawyer. Caveat emperor, you asshole. Lay one finger on me, and he and I will strip you of everything you—" Ow, ow! Wendell has stepped on a piece of broken glass, Jack sees, probably from one of the prints that formerly decorated the walls and are now decorating the floor. He takes one more off-balance lurch backward, this time steps on his own trailing slacks, and goes sprawling into the leather recliner where Dr. Spiegelman presumably sits while quizzing his patients on their troubled childhoods. La Riviere's premier muckraker stares at the approaching Neanderthal with wide, horrified eyes, then throws the minicorder at him. Jack sees that it's covered with scratches. He bats it away.
"Rape!"
Wendell squeals.
"He's raping one of the loonies! He's—"
Jack pops him on the point of the chin, pulling the punch just a little at the last moment, delivering it with almost scientific force. Wendell flops back in Dr. Spiegelman's recliner, eyes rolling up, feet twitching as if to some tasty beat that only the semi-conscious can truly appreciate. "The mad Hungarian couldn't have done better," Jack murmurs. It occurs to him that Wendell ought to treat himself to a complete neurological workup in the not-too-distant future. His head is put in a hard couple of days. The door to the hall bursts open. Jack steps in front of the recliner to hide Wendell, stuffing a shirt into his pants. At some point, he zipped his fly, thank God.
A candy striper pokes her fluffy head into Dr. Spiegelman's office. Although she's probably 18, her panic makes her look about 12.
"Who's yelling in here?" she asks. "Who's hurt?"
Jack has no idea what to say, but Judy manages like a pro.
"It was a patient," she says. "Mr. Lackley, I think. He came in, yelled that we were all going to be raped, and then ran out again."
"You have to leave at once," the candy striper tells them. "Don't listen to that idiot Ethan, and don't use the elevator. We think it was an earthquake."
"Right away," Jack says crisply, and although he doesn't move, it's good enough for the candy striper. She heads out.
Judy crosses quickly to the door. It closes, but won't latch. The frame has been subtly twisted out of true. There was a clock on the wall. Jack looks toward it, but it's fallen face down to the floor. He goes to Judy and takes her by the arms.
"How long was I over there?"
"Not long," she says. "But what an exit you made. Kapow! Did you get anything?" Her eyes plead with him.
"Enough to know I have to go back to French Landing right away," he tells her.
"Enough to know that I love you, that I'll always love you in this world or any other."
"Tyler, is he alive?"
She reverses his grip so she is holding him. Sophie did exactly the same thing in Faraway, Jack remembers.
"Is my son alive?"
"Yes, and I'm going to get him for you." His eye happens on Spiegelman's desk, which has danced its way into the room and stands with all its drawers open. He sees something interesting in one of those drawers and hurries across the carpet, crunching on broken glass and kicking aside one of the prints. In the top drawer, to the left of the desk's knee hole, is a tape recorder, considerably bigger than Wendell Green's trusty Panasonic, and a torn piece of brown wrapping paper. Jack snatches up the paper first. Scrawled across the front, in draggling letters he's seen at both Ed's Eats and on his own front porch, is this: "Deliver to Judy Marshall, also known as Sophie." There are what appear to be stamps in the upper corner of the torn sheet. Jack doesn't need to examine them closely to know that they are really cut from sugar packets, and that they were affixed by a dangerous old dodderer named Charles Burnside. But the fisherman's identity no longer matters much, and Speedy knew it. Neither does his location, because Jack has an idea Chummy Burnside can flip to a new one pretty much at will. But he can't take the real doorway with him. The doorway to the furnace lands, to Mr. Munshun, to Ty. If Beezer and his pals found that... Jack drops the wrapping paper back into the drawer, hits the eject button on the tape recorder, and pops out the cassette tape inside. He sticks it in his pocket and heads for the door.
"Jack?"
He looks back at her. Beyond them, fire alarms honk and blat, lunatics scream and laugh, staff runs to and fro. Their eyes meet. In the clear blue light of Judy's regard, Jack can almost touch that other world, with its sweet smells and strange constellations.
"Is it wonderful over there? As wonderful as in my dreams?"
"It's wonderful," he tells her. "And you are too. Hang in there, okay?" Halfway down the hallway, Jack comes upon a nasty sight. Ethan Evans, the young man who once had Wanda Kinderling as his Sunday school teacher, has laid hold of a disoriented old woman by her fat upper arms and is shaking her back and forth. The old woman's frizzy hair flies around her head.
"Shut up!" young Mr. Evans is shouting at her. "Shut up, you crazy old cow! You're not going anywhere except back to your dad-blame room!"
Something about his sneer makes it obvious that even now, with the world turned upside down, young Mr. Evans is enjoying both his power to command and his Christian duty to brutalize. This is only enough to make Jack angry. What infuriates him is the look of terrified incomprehension on the old woman's face. It makes him think of boys he once lived with long ago, in a place called the Sunlight Home. It makes him think of Wolf. Without pausing or so much as breaking stride, they have entered the endgame phase of the festivities now, and somehow he knows it, Jack drives his fist into young Mr. Evans's temple. That worthy lets go of his plump and squawking victim, strikes the wall, then slides down it, his eyes wide and dazed. "Either you didn't listen in Sunday school, or Kinderling's wife taught you the wrong lessons," Jack says.
"You hit me,"
young Mr. Evans whispers. He finishes his slow dive, splay-legged on the hallway floor, halfway between the records annex and ambulatory ophthalmology. Abuse another patient, this one, the one I was just talking to, any of them, and I'll do a lot more than that, Jack promises young Mr. Evans. Then he's down the stairs, taking them two at a time, not noticing a handful of Johnny-clad patients who stare at him with expressions of puzzled, half-fearful wonder. They look at him as if at a vision, who passes them in an envelope of light, some wonder as brilliant as it is mysterious. 10 minutes later, long after Judy Marshall has walked composedly back to her room without professional help of any kind, the alarms cut off. An amplified voice, perhaps even Dr. Spiegelman's own mother wouldn't have recognized it as her boy's, begins to blare from the overhead speakers. At this unexpected roar, patients who had pretty much calmed down begin to shriek and cry all over again. The old woman whose mistreatment so angered Jack Sawyer is crouched below the admissions counter with her hands over her head, muttering something about the Russians and civil defense.
"The emergency is over," Spiegelman assures his cast and crew. "There is no fire. Please report to the commons room on each floor. This is Dr. Spiegelman, and I repeat that the emergency is over."
Here comes Wendell Green, weaving his way slowly toward the stairwell, rubbing his chin gently with one hand. He sees young Mr. Evans and offers him a helping hand. For a moment, it looks as though Wendell may be pulled over himself, but then young Mr. Evans gets his buttocks against the wall and manages to gain his feet.
"The emergency is over. I repeat, the emergency is over. Nurses, orderlies, and doctors, please escort all patients to the common rooms on each floor."
Young Mr. Evans eyes the purple bruise rising on Wendell's chin. Wendell eyes the purple bruise rising on the temple of young Mr. Evans.
"Sawyer?"
young Mr. Evans asks.
"Sawyer,"
Wendell confirms.
"Bastard sucker punched me," young Mr. Evans confides.
"Son of a bitch came up behind me," Wendell says. "The Marshall woman, he had her down." He lowers his voice. "He was getting ready to rape her." Young Mr. Evans' whole manner says he is sorrowful but not surprised.
"Something ought to be done," Wendell says.
"You got that right.
People ought to be told."
Gradually, the old fire returns to Wendell's eyes.
"People will be told by him, because that is what he does, by God. He tells people."
"Yeah," young Mr. Evans says. He doesn't care as much as Wendell does. He lacks Wendell's burning commitment. But there's one person he will tell. One person who deserves to be comforted in her lonely hours, who has been left on her own Mount of Olives. One person who will drink up the knowledge of Jack Sawyer's evil like the very waters of life.
"This kind of behavior cannot just be swept under the rug," Wendell says.
"No way," young Mr. Evans agrees. "No way, Jose." Jack has barely cleared the gates of French County Lutheran when his cell phone tweets. He thinks of pulling over to take the call, hears the sound of approaching fire engines, and decides for once to risk driving and talking at the same time. He wants to be out of the area before the local fire brigade shows up and slows him down. He flips the little Nokia open.
"Sawyer."
"Where the fuck are you?" Beezer St. Pierre bellows.
"Man, I've been hitting redial so hard I damn near punched it off the phone."
"I've been..." But there's no way he can finish that. Not and stay within shouting distance of the truth, that is. Or maybe there is.
"I guess I got into one of those dead zones where the cell phone just doesn't pick up. Never mind the science lesson, chum. Get your ass over here right now. The actual address is 1 Nail House Row. It's County Road 00 just south of Chase. It's the baby shit brown two-story on the corner."
"I can find it," Jack says, and steps down a little harder on the Ram's gas pedal.
"I'm on my way now."
"What's your 20, man?"
"Still Arden, but I'm rolling. I can be there in maybe half an hour."
"Fuck!" There is an alarming crash rattle in Jack's ear as somewhere on Nail House Row, Beezer slams his fist against something, probably the nearest wall.
"The fuck's wrong with you, man? Mouse is going down. I mean fast. We're doing our best, those of us who are still here, but he's going down."
Beezer is panting, and Jack thinks he's trying not to cry. The thought of Armand St. Pierre in that particular state is alarming.
Jack looks at the ram speedometer, sees it's touching 70, and eases off a tad. He won't help anybody by getting himself greased in a road wreck between Arden and Centralia.
What do you mean, those of us who are still here?
Never mind, just get your butt down here if you want to talk to Mouse. And he sure wants to talk to you because he keeps saying your name.
Beezer lowers his voice.
When he ain't just raving his ass off, that is. Doc's doing his best, me and Bear Girl too, but we're shoveling shit against the tide here.
Tell him to hold on, Jack says.
Fuck that, man! Tell him yourself!
There's a rattling sound in Jack's ear, the faint murmuring of voices. Then another voice, one which hardly sounds human, speaks in his ear.
Gotta hurry. Gotta get over here, man. Thing bit me. I can feel it in there like acid.
Hold on, Mouse, Jack says. His fingers are dead white on the telephone. He wonders that the case doesn't simply crack in his grip. I'll be there fast as I can.
Better be. Others already forgot. Not me.
Mouse chuckles. The sound is ghastly beyond belief, a whiff straight out of an open grave.
I got the memory serum. You know, it's eating me up, eating me alive, but I got it.
There's the rustling sound of the phone changing hands again, then a new voice. A woman's. Jack assumes it's Bear Girl.
You got them moving, she says. You brought it to this. Don't let it be for nothing.
There is a click in his ear. Jack tosses the cell phone under the seat and decides that maybe 70 isn't too fast after all. A few minutes later, they seem like very long minutes to Jack. He's squinting against the glare of the sun on Tamarack Creek. From here he can almost see his house and Henry's. Henry. Jack thumps the side of his thumb lightly against his breast pocket and hears the rattle of the cassette tape he took from the machine in Spiegelman's office. There's not much reason to turn it over to Henry now. Given what Potter told him last night and what Mouse is holding on to tell him today, this tape and the 911 tape have been rendered more or less redundant. Besides, he's got to hurry to Nail House Row. There's a train getting ready to leave the station, and Mouse Bauman is very likely going to be on it. And yet, I'm worried about him, Jack says softly. Even a blind man could see I'm worried about Henry. The brilliant summer sun, now sliding down the afternoon side of the sky, reflects off the creek and sends shimmers of light dancing across his face. Each time this light crosses his eyes, they seem to burn. Henry isn't the only one Jack's worried about either. He's got a bad feeling about all of his new French Landing friends and acquaintances, from Dale Gilbertson and Fred Marshall, right down to such bit players as old Steamy McKay, an elderly gent who makes his living shining shoes outside the public library, and Artis Walker, who runs the ramshackle bait shop down by the river. In his imagination, all these people now seem made of glass. If the fisherman decides to sing High C, they'll vibrate and then shatter to powder. Only it's not really the fisherman he's worried about anymore. This is a case, he reminds himself. Even with all the territory's weirdness thrown in, it's still a case, and it's not the first one you've ever been on where everything suddenly started to seem too big, where all the shadows seem to be too long. True enough, but usually that funhouse sense of false perspective fades away once he starts to get a handle on things. This time, it's worse. And worse by far. He knows why, too. The fisherman's long shadow is a thing called Mr. Munshun, an immortal talent scout from some other plane of existence. Nor is even that the end, because Mr. Munshun also casts a shadow. A red one. Abala, Jack mutters. Abala, Dune, and Mr. Munshun and the crow Gorg. Just three old pals walking together on night's Plutonian shore. For some reason, this makes him think of the walrus and the carpenter from Alice. What was it they took for a walk in the moonlight? Clams? Mussels? Jack's damned if he can remember, although one line surfaces and resonates in his mind, spoken in his mother's voice. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things. The Abala is presumably hanging out in his court, the part of him that isn't imprisoned in Speedy's dark tower, that is. But the fisherman and Mr. Munshun could be anywhere. Do they know Jack Sawyer has been meddling? Of course they do. By today, that is common knowledge. Might they try to slow him down by doing something nasty to one of his friends?
A certain blind sportscaster headbanger Bebopper, for instance.
Yes, indeed.
And now, perhaps because he's been sensitized to it, he can once more feel that nasty pulse coming out of the southwestern landscape, the one he sensed when he flipped over for the first time in his adult life. When the road curves southeast, he almost loses it. Then when the ram points its nose southwest again, the poisonous throb regains strength, beating into his head like the onset of a migraine headache. That's Black House, you feel. Only it's not a house. Not really. It's a wormhole in the apple of existence, leading all the way down into the furnace lands. It's a door. Maybe it was only standing ajar before today, before Beezer and his pals turned up there, but now it's wide open and letting in one hell of a draft. Ty needs to be brought back, yes, but that door needs to be shut as well, before God knows what awful things come snarling through. Jack abruptly swings the ram onto Tamarack Road. The tires scream. His seatbelt locks, and for a moment he thinks the truck may overturn. It stays up, though, and he goes flying toward Norway Valley Road. Mouse will just have to hang on a little bit longer. He's not going to leave Henry way out here on his own. His pal doesn't know it, but he's going on a little field trip to Nail House Row. Until this situation stabilizes, it seems to Jack that the buddy system is very much in order. Which would have been all well and good if Henry had been at home, but he's not. Alvina Morton, dust mop in hand, comes in response to Jack's repeated jabbing at the doorbell.
"He's been over at KDCU doing commercials," Alvina says. "Dropped him off myself. I don't know why he doesn't just do them in his studio here. Something about the sound effects, I think he might have said. I'm surprised he didn't tell you that."
The bitch of it is Henry did. Cousin Buddy's rib crib. The old ball and chain, beautiful downtown La Riviere, all that. He even told Jack that Alvina Morton was going to drive him. A few things have happened to Jack since that conversation. He's re-encountered his old childhood friend, he's fallen in love with Judy Marshall's twinner, and just by the way, he's been filled in on your basic secret of all existence. But none of that keeps him from turning his left hand into a fist and then slamming himself directly between the eyes with it. Given how fast things are now moving, making this needless detour strikes him as an almost unforgivable lapse. Mrs. Morton is regarding him with wide-eyed alarm.
"Are you going to be picking him up, Mrs. Morton?"
"No, he's going for a drink with someone from ESPN. Henry said the fellow would bring him back afterward." She lowers her voice to the timbre of confidentiality at which secrets are somehow best communicated. "Henry didn't come right out and say so, but I think there may be big things ahead for George Rathbun. Very big things."
Badger barrage going national? Jack wouldn't be entirely surprised, but he has no time to be delighted for Henry now. He hands Mrs. Morton the cassette tape, mostly so he won't feel this was an entirely wasted trip. "Leave this for him where..." He stops. Mrs. Morton is looking at him with knowing amusement. "Where he'll be sure to see it," is what Jack almost said. Another mental miscue. Big city detective indeed.
"I'll leave it by the soundboard in his studio," she says. "He'll find it there. Jack, maybe it's none of my business, but you don't look all right. You're very pale, and I'd swear you've lost 10 pounds since last week. Also..." She looks a bit embarrassed. "Your shoes are on the wrong feet."
So they are. He makes the necessary change, standing first on one foot and then the other. "It's been a tough 48 hours, but I'm hanging in there, Mrs. M."
"It's the fisherman business, isn't it?"
He nods. "And I have to go. The fat, as they say, is in the fire." He turns, reconsiders, turns back. "Leave him a message on the kitchen tape recorder, would you? Tell him to call me on my cell just as soon as he gets in." Then, one thought leading to another, he points to the unmarked cassette tape in her hand. "Don't play that, all right?" Mrs. Morton looks shocked.
"I'd never do such a thing. It would be like opening someone else's mail."
Jack nods and gives her a scrap of a smile.
"Good. Is it him on the tape? Is it the fisherman?"
"Yes," Jack says, "it's him." "And there are worse things waiting," he thinks but doesn't say. "Worse things by far."
He hurries back to his truck, not quite running. 20 minutes later, Jack parks in front of the baby shit brown two-story at One Nail House Row. Nail House Row and the dirty snarl of streets around it strike him as unnaturally silent under the sun of this hot summer afternoon. A mongrel dog, it is in fact the old fellow we saw in the doorway of the Nelson Hotel just last night, goes limping across the intersection of Ames and County Road 00, but that's about the extent of the traffic. Jack has an unpleasant vision of the walrus and the carpenter toddling along the east bank of the Mississippi with the hypnotized residents of Nail House Row following along behind them, toddling along toward the fire and the cooking pot. He takes two or three deep breaths, trying to steady himself. Not far out of town, close to the road leading to Ed's Eats, in fact, that nasty buzzing in his head peaked, turning into something like a dark scream. For a few moments there, it was so strong, Jack wondered if he was perhaps going to drive right off the road, and he slowed the Ram to 40. Then, blessedly, it began to move around toward the back of his head and fade. He didn't see the no trespassing sign that marks the overgrown road leading to Black House. Didn't even look for it, but he knew it was there. The question is whether or not he'll be able to approach it when the time comes without simply exploding. Come on, he tells himself, no time for this shit. He gets out of the truck and starts up the cracked cement walk. There's a fading hopscotch diagram there, and Jack swerves to avoid it without even thinking, knowing it's one of the few remaining artifacts which testify that a little person named Amy St. Pierre once briefly trod the boards of existence. The porch steps are dry and splintery. He's vilely thirsty and thinks, man, I'd kill for a glass of water. Or a nice cold, the door flies open, cracking against the side of the house like a pistol shot in the sunny silence, and Beezer comes running out. Christ almighty, I didn't think you were ever going to get here. Looking into Beezer's alarmed, agonized eyes, Jack realizes that he will never tell this guy that he might be able to find Black House without Mouse's help. That thanks to his time in the territories, he has a kind of rangefinder in his head. No, not even if they live the rest of their lives as close friends, the kind who usually tell each other everything. The Bees has suffered like Job, and he doesn't need to find out that his friend's agony may have been in vain. Is he still alive, Beezer? By an inch, maybe an inch and a quarter. It's just me and Doc and Bear Girl now. Sonny and Kaiser Bill got scared, ran off like a couple of whipped dogs. March your boots in here, sunshine. Not that Beezer gives Jack any choice. He grabs him by the shoulder and hauls him into the little two-story on Nail House Row like luggage. Chapter 23. One more, says the guy from ESPN. It sounds more like an order than a request, and although Henry can't see the fellow, he knows this particular homeboy never played a sport in his life, pro or otherwise. He has the lardy, slightly oily aroma of someone who has been overweight almost from the jump. Sports is perhaps his compensation, with the power to still memories of clothes bought in the husky section at Sears, and all those childhood rhymes like fatty, fatty, 2x4, had to do it on the floor, couldn't get through the bathroom door. His name is Penniman. Just like Little Richard, he told Henry when they shook hands at the radio station. Famous rock and roller from back in the 50s? Maybe you remember him. Vaguely, Henry said, as if he hadn't at one time owned every single Little Richard had ever put out. I believe he was one of the founding fathers, Penniman laughed uproariously, and in that laugh Henry glimpsed a possible future for himself. But was it a future he wanted? People laughed at Howard Stern, too, and Howard Stern was a dork. One more drink, Penniman repeats now. They are in the bar of the Oak Tree Inn, where Penniman has tipped the bartender $5 to switch the TV from bowling on ABC to ESPN, even though there's nothing on at this hour of the day except golf tips and bass fishing. One more drink just to seal the deal. But they don't have a deal, and Henry isn't sure he wants to make one. Going national with George Rathbun as part of the ESPN radio package should be attractive, and he doesn't have any serious problem with changing the name of the show from Badger Barrage to ESPN Sports Barrage. It would still focus primarily on the central and northern areas of the country. But what? Before he can even get to work on the question, he smells it again.
My sin, the perfume his wife used to wear on certain evenings when she wanted to send a certain signal. Lark was what he used to call her on those certain evenings when the room was dark and they were both blind to everything but scents and textures and each other. Lark.
You know, I think I'm going to pass on that drink, Henry says. Got some work to do at home, but I'm going to think over your offer. And I mean seriously.
Ah, Penniman says. And Henry can tell from certain minute disturbances in the air that the man is shaking a finger beneath his nose.
Henry wonders how Penniman would react if Henry suddenly darted his head forward and bit off the offending digit at the second knuckle. If Henry showed him a little coolie country hospitality fisherman style. How loud would Penniman yell? As loud as Little Richard before the instrumental break of Tutti Frutti, perhaps, or not quite as loud as that?
Can't go till I'm ready to take you, Mr. I'm Fat But It No Longer Matters tells him. I'm your ride, you know.
He's on his fourth gimlet, and his words are slightly slurred.
My friend, Henry thinks, I'd poke a ferret up my ass before I'd get into a car with you at the wheel.
Actually, I can, Henry says pleasantly.
Nick Avery, the bartender, is having a kick-ass afternoon. The fat guy slipped him $5 to change the TV channel, and the blind guy slipped him $5 to call Skeeter's taxi while the fat guy was in the bathroom making a little room.
Huh?
I said, actually, I can. Bartender?
He's outside, sir, Avery tells him, pulled up 2 minutes ago.
There is a hefty creak as Penniman turns on his bar stool. Henry can't see the man's frown as he takes in the taxi, now idling in the hotel turnaround, but he can sense it.
Listen, Henry, Penniman says, I think you may lack a certain understanding of your current situation.
There are stars in the firmament of sports radio. Damn right there are. People like the fabulous Sports Babe and Tony Kornheiser make 6 figures a year just in speaking fees. 6 figures easy.
But you ain't there yet. That door is currently closed to you. But I, my friend, am one hell of a doorman. The upshot is that if I say we ought to have one more drink, then bartender, Henry says quietly, then shakes his head.
I can't just call you bartender. It might work for Humphrey Bogart, but it doesn't work for me. What's your name?
Nick Avery, sir.
The last word comes out automatically, but Avery never would have used it when speaking to the other one, never in a million years. Both guys tipped him $5, but the one in the dark glasses is the gent. It's got nothing to do with him being blind, it's just something he is.
Nick, who else is at the bar?
Avery looks around. In one of the back booths, 2 men are drinking beer. In the hall, a bellman is on the phone. At the bar itself, no one at all except for these 2 guys. One slim, cool, and blind, the other fat, sweaty, and starting to be pissed off.
No one, sir.
There's not a lady? Lark, he's almost said. There's not a lark.
Nope.
Listen here, Penniman says, and Henry thinks he's never heard anyone so unlike Little Richard Penniman in his entire life. This guy is whiter than Moby Dick, and probably about the same size.
We've got a lot more to discuss here.
A lot more to discuss is how it comes out. Unless, that is, unless you're trying to let me know you're not interested.
Never in a million years, Penniman's voice says to Henry Layden's educated ears. We're talking about putting a money machine in your living room, sweetheart, your very own private ATM, and there ain't no way in hell you're going to turn that down.
Nick, you don't smell perfume. Something very light and old-fashioned, my sin, perhaps.
A flabby hand falls on Henry's shoulder like a hot water bottle.
The sin, oh buddy, would be for you to refuse to have another drink with me.
Even a blind man could see the suggest you get your hand off him, Avery says.
And perhaps Penniman's ears aren't entirely deaf to nuance, because the hand leaves Henry's shoulder at once.
Then another hand comes in its place, higher up. It touches the back of Henry's neck, in a cold caress that's there and then gone. Henry draws in breath. The smell of perfume comes with it. Usually scents fade after a period of exposure, as the receptors that caught them temporarily deaden. Not this time, though. Not this smell.
No perfume, Henry almost pleads. The touch of her hand on his neck he can dismiss as a tactile hallucination. But his nose never betrays him. Never until now, anyway.
I'm sorry, Avery says. I can smell beer, peanuts, this man's gin, and his aftershave.
Henry nods. The lights above the back bar slide across the dark lenses of his shades as he slips gracefully off his stool.
I think you want another drink, my friend,
Penniman says, in what he no doubt believes to be a tone of polite menace.
One more drink just to celebrate, and then I'll take you home in my Lexus.
Henry smells his wife's perfume. He's sure of it, and he seemed to feel the touch of his wife's hand on the back of his neck. Yet suddenly it's skinny little Morris Rosen he finds himself thinking about. Morris, who wanted him to listen to Where Did Our Love Go as done by Dirty Sperm. And, of course, for Henry to play it in his Wisconsin rat persona. Morris Rosen, who has more integrity in one of his nail-chewed little fingers than this bozo has got in his entire body. He puts a hand on Penniman's forearm. He smiles into Penniman's unseen face and feels the muscles beneath his palm relax. Penniman has decided he's going to get his way. Again.
You take my drink, Henry says pleasantly. Add it to your drink. And then stick them both up your fat and be-pimpled ass. If you need something to hold them in place, why, you can stick your job up there right after them.
Henry turns and walks briskly toward the door, orienting himself with his usual neat precision and holding one hand out in front of him as an insurance policy. Nick Avery has broken into spontaneous applause, but Henry barely hears this, and Penniman he has already dismissed from his mind. What occupies him is the smell of my sin perfume. It fades a little as he steps out into the afternoon heat. But is that not an amorous sigh he hears beside his left ear? The sort of sigh his wife sometimes made just before falling asleep after love. His Rhoda. His Lark.
Hello, the taxi? He calls from the curb beneath the awning.
Right here, buddy. What are you, blind?
As a bat.
Henry agrees, and walks toward the sound of the voice. He'll go home, he'll put his feet up, he'll have a glass of tea, and then he'll listen to the damn 911 tape. That as-yet-unperformed chore may be what's causing his current case of the heebie-jeebies and shaky shivers, knowing that he must sit in darkness and listen to the voice of a child-killing cannibal. Surely that must be it, because there's no reason to be afraid of his Lark, is there? If she were to return and haunt him, she would surely haunt with love, wouldn't she?
Yes, he thinks, and lowers himself into the taxi's stifling back seat.
Where to, buddy?
Norway Valley Road, Henry says. It's a white house with blue trim standing back from the road. You'll see it not long after you cross the creek.
Henry settles back in the seat and turns his troubled face toward the open window. French Landing feels strange to him today. Fraught, like something that has slipped and slipped until it is now on the verge of simply falling off the table and smashing to pieces on the floor. Say that she has come back. Say that she has. If it's love she's come with, why does the smell of her perfume make me so uneasy, so almost revolted? And why was her touch, her imagined touch, he assures himself, so unpleasant? Why was her touch so cold?
After the dazzle of the day, the living room of Beezer's crib is so dark that at first Jack can't make out anything. Then, when his eyes adjust a little, he sees why. Blankets, a double thickness from the look, have been hung over both of the living room windows, and the door to the other downstairs room, almost certainly the kitchen, has been closed.
He can't stand the light, Beezer says. He keeps his voice low so it won't carry across to the far side of the room, where the shape of a man lies on a couch. Another man is kneeling beside him.
Maybe the dog that bit him was rabid, Jack says. He doesn't believe it.
Beezer shakes his head decisively. It isn't a phobic reaction. Doc says it's physiological. Where the light falls on him, his skin starts to melt. You ever hear of anything like that?
No.
And Jack has never smelled anything like the stench in this room, either. There's the buzz of not one, but two table fans, and he can feel the cross-draft, but that stink is too gluey to move. There's the reek of spoiled meat, of gangrene and torn flesh,
But Jack has smelled that before. It's the other smell that's getting to him. Something like blood and funeral flowers and feces all mixed up together. He makes a gagging noise, can't help it, and Beezer looks at him with a certain impatient sympathy.
Bad, yeah, I know. But it's like the monkey house at the zoo, man. You get used to it after a while.